What does hitting the button mean?
That means I'm starting the broadcast, which means we are live right now. So welcome to Tone Talk with Mark Uzansky and Dave Friedman. Tonight's guest is an awesome dude, James Brown. He has been working in the amplifier business and the pedal business for a really long time. And we're honored to have you here, man. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
No problem. I learned about you recently, I'd probably say within the past year, from Keith Bears at the Guitar Guru Network. Keith's a great guy. And so we were kind of going back and forth. And then I wanted to reach out and say hi to you. So thanks. Thanks for joining us. And Dave, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Not bad. Not bad at all. Hey, in reference to our last show, I have to make an apology to Marshall Amplification. I said some misinformation in the show that proved not to be true, and I sincerely apologize for that. So
there you go. All right. There we go. We'll move on from there. Yes. So, James, where are you located? You're in Georgia, right?
Yeah, I'm in Cumming, Georgia, which is just about 30 miles north of Atlanta, right up by Lake Lanier, which is a pretty cool place.
Yeah, it's real nice. Is it cold right around now, getting chilly?
Yeah, it's a lot colder than where either of you fuckers are. California and Florida, and I'm in Atlanta, and you'd think it would be real warm here, but no, it's pretty cold.
It fluctuates greatly here.
Yeah, so
it's like 80 during the day, but then at you wake up first like 6 a.m. in the morning, you go outside and it's 35.
That's pretty bad.
We always have that to deal with.
Yeah, well, it's
massive
been
fluctuation.
not much here. I'd say, you know, we just last week it got down to like in the 50s, and then now we're back up in the like the normal whatever. So that was our winter, I think.
That was it, right?
Yeah. That was it. It kind of came by for 3 days. So James, you know, it's awesome to have you on. You've really worked with some great artists, including Van Halen. You've worked with Joe Satriani. I've read Adrian Vandenberg, and you also have your own company, Amp Tweaker. If you wouldn't mind, just kind of give us a background on how you got into this business. Like, what's your background?
Well, you know, I grew up in Mississippi, and I went to college to study electronics. And then after I finished college, I actually went to Peavey a few times, bugging them to try to get a job there, basically. You know, because that's what I told my wife I was going to do. I was like, I'm going to get a job at Peavey designing amps or something, you know. And after some persistence, I was teaching classes at USM, Southern Mississippi, after I finished. And I used to bring kids up there to see the factory because, frankly, Peavey had a pretty phenomenal manufacturing system. I mean, with circuit board insertion machines and the whole nine yards. And they had some of the first CAD systems that anybody that had ever seen back then. You're talking about 86, 87, stuff like that. So that was kind of a big deal for a bunch of electronics students to see some cool CAD software machinery and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I took them up there all the time doing seminars with PV guys and meeting them. And eventually I did manage to get on there, work for Jack Sondermeyer for about 18 years, actually. And I didn't learn a bunch of tube stuff. You know, a lot of guys learned how to do tube amps and stuff probably from repairing other ones and things like that.
That's probably like Dave,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So Dave, you've done a lot of repairs and stuff over the years and
all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
I didn't really have that background. I mean, I kind of, my whole thing was I played guitar and I learned the electronics, and then I went to Peavey, and I basically, those guys kind of gave me the ropes, you know. They kind of taught me some of the things, but the difference was they didn't play guitar, so they couldn't really translate a lot of that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
if you play, it's a whole lot easier to translate the details. You know, you try something and you say, well, that feels like crap. You know, I don't want to do that ever again,
right?
You know, or something. And so, you know, I basically learned as I went along. You know, first amp I did at PB was a VTM, which was about 87, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
The VTM. There was a lot of amp modding going on at the time. People were taking JCM 800s and tweaking them and stuff and boosting the gain. You know, sometimes they'd move some EQ points around and stuff like that. And
with all the little dip switches, right?
We did that dip switch thing on the VTM. Hartley thought it would be cool, rather than just modifying an amp and it being and it sounding cool, what if you put that little dip switch on there and you made it so the guy could tweak the ones he liked, and then you put the little cover back over it so none of the guys that walked up to you at the gig would know which ones you had.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a, you know, kind of a neat little trick. Of course, now you could make a fortune selling those little covers because nobody has them anymore.
Right. You know,
I actually have had guys approach me about it online. I was going to do like a special cover with my signature on it or something. Yeah, I'll sell you a cover, all right.
Wasn't in developing that amp, weren't you, what was it, Mark Ferrari's amp or something?
You know, you guys had
or something?
I don't even remember.
Modded Marshall.
There was some kind of Marshall that had been modified, and they had some mods, and we had some ideas, and one of the things we did, there was a lot of mods where guys would put effects loops in Marshalls.
Yeah.
But what they were doing is they were tacking it right at the input. So it would go from the input jack to the effects loop and then to the tube.
You looked at a Jose.
That's how that was done. And it's like, you know, well, hell, that's the same thing as plugging it in front of the amp. Yeah. So what we did is on the VTM, what we did is we took a after the EQ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need effects at that point on a tube amp. The level's way too high for pedals and stuff. It's just dramatically too high. So what we did is we divided the signal down right there, ran out a buffer, and then we put the loop on there, and then we boosted the signal back up. So basically, after all the preamp distortion, you could have your effects loop.
Yep.
So it was a completely different approach than that approach. But, of course, some of the tone mods and some of the gain boost things were similar, you know, as far as the gain and stuff.
Yeah, the amp, there's a VTM in one mode with the switches in a certain mode is basically a signal path of a old Jose mod. Which supposedly it was Mark Ferrari's amp, which might have been what you looked at the time.
At the time, I didn't even deal with that part of the things. I basically pretty much did whatever they – I mean, I'd been there like 3 months, you know.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, cool. I'll make this thing work, you know. And we did a bunch of other cool things like doing we tried some cool things the rest of the company didn't want to do. Like I did Sondermeyer came up with this quarter power switch, was really cool, where we cut the voltage in half, which cuts the power by 1/4.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had a little automatic bias adjustment that went with it.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty cool little treat, but everybody was scared to do that. They were like, nah, we better just do a 60 and a 120 because people won't understand all that power switch stuff. And it's like, of course, you know, the rest of the story is within 5 years, everybody was doing half power switches everywhere. It's all you see, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was my first project, was that VTM. We started with the Butcher, which was a an old Marshall clone type of thing that they had. And to be honest, you know, you brought up Van Halen. When he came to Peavy, that was we hooked him through all the different things we had. You know, it was an exciting deal. Of course, nobody was any more excited than I was because, I mean, I was when I was in 11th grade was when that first album hit, you know.
Right.
So, you know, getting to even meet Eddie Van Halen was kind of a big deal.
So what he was going around just to back up a second, he was going around to different manufacturers to see what they could do.
Yeah, exactly. He had this supposed amp, and it was supposed to be some Jose modded amp I never saw, frankly. But that was the premise, was he had this amp and he was going around trying to find a company that would build this amp in such a way that a regular guy could afford it.
Yeah, it was.
That was his whole premise.
It's an interesting story, and I can elaborate on that a little bit. During the time, Jose had made him a prototype amp. It was like the size of an SVT or something.
Yeah.
And I had been at his place, and I had actually seen it. I've seen it in person. And the funny thing is, no one today knows where that amp is or what happened to it. It's vanished. Van Halen doesn't have it. No one has it. It's gone.
All I can tell you is we never saw it.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole thing is they were farming it around, and it was this amp that he would talk about.
Yeah.
But you know, he came to the factory, and we did a big dog and pony show and set up every amp I had, you know, everything we had. We had the VTM, we had the Ultras, mm-hmm. I had a Rockmaster preamp and a classic 50-50 power amp behind it, and that had the resonance and presence control in it, which he dug. But of all those different amps, he liked the VTM the best. Of course, it's the closest thing probably to a lot of those modded Marshalls that were going on at the time.
Yeah.
And it was kind of interesting watching him play through a PV Tracer that they had brought in with one pickup on it, and they had the tremolo was floating, which he doesn't do. And he just grabbed this thing up and sound like Eddie Van Halen, you know what I'm saying? It's like I was like, well, damn, we're done. Sounds exactly like him. Sounds exactly like his tone.
Right.
And it was just him playing through that VTM and just ripping. And, you know, he could play through a pig nose and it sound just as light, just the same, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But,
that's true.
But that was the premise, was he was going to all these different companies and trying to find somebody that could build this Jose modded amp but do it in such a way that a kid could buy it. And that was a big thing for him. It was like, you know, it's one thing for all these artists and stuff to be able to spend millions of dollars or, you know, not millions, but thousands of dollars to get their amps modded and to buy expensive stuff. But he was looking for a way to make something that a regular person could buy, mm-hmm. and get a decent sound, you know. And admittedly, you know, when I was a kid, the reason I got into this was because in 79 or 78 or 9, there was nothing out there you could play and get any of the sounds that you'd hear on the records.
Right.
I mean, you couldn't. You could take that old Marshall, even the Master Volume Marshall, it sounded like a clean amp to me. Right. You know, in comparison to, but I didn't know you had to turn every knob all the way up and stand in the next room, you know, to get that tone. And so that was what drew me into this business, was to try to figure out ways to be able to get that sound at a reasonable volume, you know. And frankly, even that VTM had to get pretty loud to start getting that tone, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Now, just out of curiosity, James, what other companies was he looking at the time before he landed
I didn't get too much in the business part. I do think that maybe Fender was approached at that point, but wasn't. Who knows why he ended up picking Peavy? You know, maybe it was really important to us and not as important to them, or he knew that if he came to us, he'd be the guy, you know, he'd be our flagship, so mm-hmm. to speak, you know, and frankly, it was. I mean, by the time I got that thing finished and we started shipping them, it was a big deal. And we sold 10,000 Rages that year, the little $100 amp, just mm-hmm. because it was a significantly increased production of even those kind of things because of the
trickle down yeah. effect, right? Yeah. Yeah.
It was like you had credibility. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so
I was going to say, take us back if you don't mind to just the process. You know, so were you the main guy working with him, or do you have a team that was working?
I mean, it was, there's always a team that works on stuff like this. As far as, I had circuit board guys, a guy named mm-hmm. Keith Varner used to do the circuit board layouts back then, and he worked on it, and Freddie Eves worked on it. There were marketing guys that got involved in stuff. Hartley came up with ideas. I was the head engineer over the project, and I was the one that went back and forth with him on tweaks and coming up with, it's not quite right and all that stuff.
I'm sure that was vast.
It was, he was drinking a good bit at that time. So it was kind of a roller coaster, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
We'd think we were done. And then the next day he'd call back and say, I don't know, it sounds like cardboard, and I'd be like, I don't know what cardboard is, but I'll try to take that shit out of there if I can. And it was like, at the time he was using a bunch of different amps. He was working on, they were recording the For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge album, and he was using a Soldano. He had his Super League 100, mm-hmm. which everybody says is modified. Frankly, it was a stock amp. I played it. You just turn it all the way up, you get that sound, but the other trick to that sound is that he also would turn it all the way up, play it through one cabinet so the speakers are distorting, and then go in the mixer in the sound room and cut some of the mid-range down and boost the bass a little bit after you mic it up. Mm-hmm. So what you got standing next to it was that loud mid-rangey flat tone. But what you got at the mixer, by the time you EQ'd it with the mixing EQ a little bit, is that sound that we all, heard.
Right.
But cool. At that time they were using those various different amps and variacking them and all these things. And so we were supposed to get this, once they made the business arrangements and got it all worked out, they were supposed to send us this Jose amp. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't think it was real cool, because it's like, what do you need me for if you're just going to take this guy's amp and just throw it into production? Why do you even need me to tweak it or anything?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turned out the amp never materialized. We waited and waited and waited. And they'd already worked out the deal. Months go by and we hadn't heard, we can't get an amp. So I don't know if it exists or doesn't exist or what.
It did exist.
Like Dave said, it existed, but I never played it. And I worked and I was at the studio many times over those, 10, 15 years. I never saw it. But anyway, at some point, Hartley was like, look, we got to get this thing going. He doesn't really know. I don't know about this amp, if it exists or not. So just, he liked the VTM. Let's start with that as a platform, and see if you can tweak it a little bit to make it sound more like the Soldano and the SLO and the various things that he likes, the Super Lead. And so I, of course I got a Soldano. I checked it out. It had some EQ tricks, had a little bit of gain stagery, some tone things that were a little bit different. They put their EQ, they put their effects loop in a better place than that mod I was telling you about a minute ago, but it was still
a crappy place.
Yeah, it was before the master volume, which is kind of goofy, but although it means that it's before the EQ and the master, so it's kind of like I didn't understand that, so I didn't do it that way. I basically did put the effects loop after, like we had it in the VTM, after the EQ,
right?
Because that it gives you the best chance of having good headroom through your effects. if you're not cranking the amp up, why drive the effects loop with this monster signal was the point, you know. So anyway, we did that, and then we had the resonance and presence I was talking about from the classic power amps. So I thought, well, you know, that's, we need to put some stuff in here that we can, that A is patented, then B is something kind of unique to our deal, you know, our brand. So I stuck that stuff in there and the effects loop and all that. And then we built one up. And to be honest, I don't know if you guys have seen a VTM, but it had the double walls. It was thick like a Marshall on the sides of the head. And then the chassis was kind of angled back, like a fender angled back type of deal, but at the bottom, and then they had grill cloth above it. So we took it, and it had the lightning bolt logo, as we all fondly called it. And we took it to him, and the first thing out of his mouth was, well, this logo is not going to work. We got to have that. So can't we use that block logo that was on the PA and stuff? And so you know, Len McRae was the artist relations guy, and he dealt with that side of the issues. I tried to stay out of that stuff as much as I could, you know. But they did manage to decide to use that block logo, which was, if you've ever seen it, it's a cool, it's just a real straight kind of skinny logo that says Peavy. And it had a triangle for the A that was a delta, which is kind of a double entendre because the delta is where the blues came from, right? The PV delta, the Mississippi Delta. And it means change and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of a cool logo.
That's the one right behind you, actually, I think, right?
Yeah, right. The PV logo. And another thing that was kind of – but anyway, we showed up with that VTM-looking head. And if anybody's ever looked at a 5150, you'll notice that when you look at the circuit board, right about that far behind the pots, there's a row of jumpers. Right? The reason is because the amp started out with that angled chassis. So it was angled like that. We had to break that board to angle the pots up. It's got circuit board mounted pots. So we put ribbon cables across those that gap to make that angle on the front. Right. So that is a
workaround, right?
Well, that jumper thing, that was when I changed the design to the square look that he preferred. Instead of getting rid of all that, I was like, screw that. I ain't changing nothing. So I just put a row of jumpers where those ribbon cables were so that it would be close to the same sound. Stuff like that will screw you up. You know, if you're, I'm sure you're aware of, you know, when you've ever done any redesigns on something, you start moving things around and all bets are off.
Different.
Exactly. So.
Yeah. Once you finalize that, it's like you left everything. Okay. That's it. Everything's going to be exactly the same.
Yeah. And then you fight with some guy that wants to move something about that far. I'm like, no, leave it right where it is because, you know, I don't want to have to go back and reevaluate what changes because of that move that you make. So
yeah, you can even see that in that circuit. There's some parts that are doubled up to make a value.
Yeah.
And stuff that you did, and you just left it.
I left it, man. I wasn't screwing with that after the fact.
No.
Like, who cares?
I understand.
I don't want to lose the recipe.
I deal with Ed, and I understand that reasoning.
Yeah. Well, he even kind of has the philosophy of sometimes if you do something that, well, I'll tell you a story. On the 5152, I'm jumping around a little bit, but that's all right.
That's cool.
On 5152, we built a couple of three prototypes, and one of them he thought was just awesome. He's like, man, this one kills those other two for some reason. So the next time I went out there, I looked at it, and come to find out, the girl that Marilyn Carr was her name that built the circuit boards and stuff for us in the lab. She stuffed the wrong capacitor in there, and she put a 2.2 mic capacitor where it was supposed to be a 22, and I think it was on the first input tube, you know, the cathode. And, you know, that completely changes the attack of the sound. So that one had less low end going into the front end of the amp, and it made it a little bit chunkier on the crunch sound and the clean sound, a little bit more British, if you will, like the bright input. And so I had to change them all to that accidental thing. And once he found out it was an accident, he liked it even more. You know, because he knew.
That makes sense, too.
Yeah, because it meant something. It was like
it was meant to be.
It was a gift. It was a gift from heaven, you know, that resistor, that capacitor was changed. And, you know, it may have been. Maybe it was a gift.
You know? But he audibly was able to tell, like, this one sounds different.
That particular value, you know, you can ask Dave. It's like the cathode on the first tube is a pretty critical thing. And some things like a lot of the old Marshalls used like a 0.68 microfarad, a smaller value, and that would roll off some low end, so it would be a little tighter. Mm-hmm. And then you got more modern stuff, like a lot of the Boogies and stuff have like a 22 mic capacitor, and I've used 22s a lot. A lot of the Fender stuff has 22, which gives you a fatter, a little bit more bottom end on the clean sounds. So that value was critical, and changing it from a 22 to a 2.2 was like a, you know, kind of a dramatic thing. But of course, we missed it when we shipped it out of there because we were in a hurry to send him another one or whatever the situation was. So
that's wild. That's so cool. So take us back if you don't mind. So how long a process was it when you brought that first prototype?
You know, I took the first prototype. It's kind of funny. We showed up, Lynn McRae and I showed up with it
at 5150 at his studio.
Yeah, at studio. And you know, I mean, this was an important deal for the company, and so we were making, it was a big deal. Even, as I recall, our salesman for that area showed up with us, and it was like, you know, we did the whole thing, you know, we all showed up together. Steve Bowman, I believe, is the guy that was there with us. Mm-hmm. And now I'm old, so I'm going to forget some names. I'm going to say the wrong stuff every now and then, but hopefully these guys will be okay with that. Cause they're old too, so they know how it is. We showed up and he played through the amp, and he was just almost in tears. He was so happy. And I was like, man, I can't believe it. How in the hell was I supposed to, how would I ever have nailed it? Just like, you know, the first try. And he was hugging us and all this stuff. And the next day he called Lynn back. He said, I don't know, man. It just doesn't sound as good today. It just sounds like cardboard. And that's the same face I made. I was like, I could feel it coming. I could tell it was fixing to be a long road of hope, you know. Mm-hmm. And I probably made three more trips out there before we finally got it. And what happened is I would make tweaks, boost a gain here or there, make a little adjustment. And he would be pretty happy with it. And then later he'd call us back and, you know, want me to come back out there and mess with it some more.
Yeah, tell the real story, yep.
Right. And, you know, you can imagine by this time, everybody at the factory, they're used to us designing something, and a year later we start shipping them and selling them and make money on it or whatever, like a business would operate, you know.
Had they had an artist before? An artist?
Oh yeah, we'd worked with plenty of guys, but not
on that level.
I don't think at that level. I mean, Adrian was pretty big. You know, there were some guys before that were pretty big, but not in rock.
Adrian Vandenberg.
Vandenberg was a big deal, but we worked with I wasn't there at the time, but earlier on they were working with Neil Sean, you know, in their heyday. So they worked with some big guys. And, of course, Skinner, you know, Leonard Skinner always used Peavey, and so did 38 Special. So they had dealt with that issue, but this was different. It was like a different, you know, it was like a different category.
It's a whole other level, yeah.
I think it's a whole nother level, but it's also, it's a different genre of music, and it wasn't something that we had really, you know, been into. Now, I was into it, you know, it was exciting to me to get to try to work on something like that, because I was trying to get those sounds anyway, you know, and we learned a lot of things through him about cabinetry and about speakers and about amps and tone and everything. Hmm. But that first project, I think it took probably a year or two to actually start shipping them. And the last time I went to the studio before, you know, when I was trying to iron it out, you know, I had already done a second prototype and redone it all so that it was put together the way we were going to build it. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, and everybody was like, okay, we're going to start shipping them this time period or that time period. It kept moving out. And finally I went back one more time. I kept thinking we were that close, you know, but we weren't that close. And the way it was is we were that close. And so what I had to do is, he couldn't really describe exactly what he was looking for, but basically it didn't have enough gain is the simple way to say it. And I kept fighting it. I was trying to, okay, I'll boost it here. That didn't work. I'll boost it over here. Nah, that doesn't help. You know, and I've got resistor boxes and capacitor boxes, and I'm flipping values in and out, trying different things. And I had my spectrum analyzer with me and all this curving stuff and trying to figure out where I'm losing it. And finally, I just said, okay, I give up. And I just added another tube to it. And I really didn't want to. And I knew it was going to mean, you know, all the tubes were on a circuit board about that big. And I knew if I added a tube, I was going to have to make the board bigger, move everything on the chassis, change the circuit boards the whole night. I'm talking about start over time, just mm-hmm. about. You know what I mean, Dave? I'm sure there's been plenty of stuff where you think you're there, and then you get to start over from scratch. You know, almost.
Yeah. That happens. And especially if dealing with someone like an artist, especially like him. Yeah. So.
Well, he didn't know. He couldn't. He wasn't sure how to explain to me what it was it wasn't doing. And I was, back home, I got people hounding me. Can we start building these things? So I'm trying to do things to get that in preparation, you know, releasing parts of it to production and stuff.
What I always find interesting is that it's like over the years, it was stepping up in gain more and more and more. He always wants more. And, and like, for instance, you know, the compared to the Soldano, it has a hell of a lot more gain.
Yeah.
You know, but yet he was using the Soldano and not with the gain maxed out, you know, and for recording and that recording that record and everything. So, I don't know. I too much gain personally, but
well,
it's even worse now. It's even more now.
Not only gain, but high end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the highs were also a big deal. You know, as we were going through the process, and we got to the later on, we got to about the 5152. I brought it in. At that time he was using those. I'm trying to think, what are those cables that are real low capacitance?
The Georgiel?
Yeah, the Georgiel cables. And I had not messed with any of them yet. Brought the prototype in there, and we were playing through it, and I'm like, damn, that thing's scratchy sounding. And I was like, dude, I don't remember it sound like that when I was working on it back home. I must have dropped it funny or something. and then about halfway through, he goes, all right, well, let's try it with a regular cable. And he pulls out a regular cable, and I couldn't believe how much difference it was, you know. Because, of course, that first tube has a lot of Miller effect capacitance, and the cable capacitance works with that. And you end up with a situation where, you know, you don't even realize that the cable's part of your tone. You know, a lot of people don't get that. The cable is actually rolling off some of that guitar high end. Some of that sizzly, crackly stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
and even making your amp a little more stable a lot of times, mm-hmm. you know. But he was also using a metal pick by that time, things like that. Well, I can tell you why. It's like the first time I was there, about, I guess, two-thirds of the way through the process of designing that first dam, they had they were almost done with the front off of carnal knowledge, and he let me check it out. And we sat in the sound room, in the control room, and he said, "Come here and sit right here." And he put me behind the control desk. And he had these speakers on up on the wall that were as big as a house, you know, one over here and one over here. And he stood next to me and made me listen to that whole album. I wouldn't have got up for $100 million, you know, because I was hearing something nobody had heard before except him and Andy Johns, you know, and these other guys.
Right.
And
that's so cool.
And he turned it on and he started cranking it up, and I was watching him, and every few seconds he'd grab that knob and go, just a little bit more. And by the time he was through, man, it was like, it was kicking my ass, but it sure was awesome, you know? So the first time I ever heard "For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge," it was in Eddie Van Halen's studio with him turning it up as loud as it could go.
That's awesome.
It was a pretty neat thing.
You think he has hearing issues after all the years?
Oh yeah. Like many guys who use, you know, full stacks. And you think about it, you know, nowadays after things like the Soldano, like the 5150 and the dual rectifier, by that time, a lot of amps, you could get a low volume, have that kind of sound, you know, but back in the day, you couldn't do that. You know, when he first started out, he's playing a Super Lead 100. And I'm talking about every knob wide open. Uh-huh. There's nothing louder than that on the planet except a jet. And, right, Dave? I mean, that stuff's
absolutely loud. That'll kind of neuter you, basically.
Especially if you're going into the bright input like that, you know, so that it's just, you know, it's just screech, you know, hey, if you don't know how to handle it, you know.
Just as a side note, I just got to interrupt. Dave, I got my earplugs. I've got these special made earplugs from the doctor. And I turned the BE 100 one day when everybody was at work. I turned it up like probably like the 8. Mm-hmm. And it was screaming.
Your neighbor's killing you.
And I had the window, you know, I had the blinds open. And I saw my neighbor come from his front door and kind of look over to the house and kind of went like that, kind of gave this look. And I was like, all right, it's time to turn it down now. Exactly. Yeah, so he heard it right across from the street. So it was funny. Yep. So, yeah. So sorry to interrupt you, James. Go ahead.
That's all right.
Yeah, it was funny. But, yeah, so, okay. I had to interrupt you with that story and then I lost your train of thought. But so you worked with them, and then it was like a year later or 2 years later, they shipped the amp, and then clearly it was a success, right?
Yeah. We started shipping them, and, you know, the first time everybody saw them live was on that MTV Music Awards thing, which was pretty awesome. We all built a bunch of, they wanted to tour with like a whole wall with double cabinets and double heads on top, and they were all red, black, and white striped. So we got a bunch of white vinyl made and actually painted them with the stripe job and everything, and they were pretty awesome looking.
Yeah.
And everybody in the engineering department participated in that. I'm talking about everybody. Everybody wanted to help paint those things, and we all got in there and painted them and tweaked them and, you know, touched them up. We built 8 amps for the first tour, and I had them all out in the lab, out in the plant rather, that we had an area that was used for testing things to make sure that they would pass. It was called a QA test thing for reliability. I don't remember what we called it, but anyway, they would run all kind of tests on stuff to make sure that it was durable and wasn't going to blow up or anything. And I had them all out there burning in. And somebody came in there and said, "Hey, man, one of those amps out there is smoking." And I was like, "What?" So I went out there, and sure enough, one of them had tube had arced or some crap. So we fixed that one, and We got through with all those 8 amps and sent them all to him. And then he and Matt Brock, the guy that was teching for him, from then and probably from then on, he's been with him for a long time.
Yeah.
They went through all the heads, all 8 of them, and they picked out the 4 badassest ones. And they and then between those 4, they put them in a rack of 4 heads, and then they picked out the one he liked the best. And, you know, tube amps, even if you do circuit boards, no matter what you do, you still got tube variations. They don't all sound absolutely exactly the same. They sound close. They sound real close. But you play with them for 30 minutes, and you can hear that one of them just wants to go better, you know, or whatever it is. And so they picked out one that they liked the best, and then they started the tour. And the first show was actually here in Atlanta. It was it was one of those sheds down south of town. And I remember, I mean, I'm gonna sound a little geeky here because, like I told you before, I was in the 11th grade when Eddie Van Halen appeared out of nowhere and made us all throw our picks away for a couple of weeks, you know. Like, well, I obviously can't play guitar anymore now. Let's start over.
Yeah, that's what everybody felt.
Right.
By the way, you can't be too geeky on this show.
Okay, well, good. Okay. Well, I'll continue then. I remember before the show started, of course, you know, I got to do the backstage thing, and we were hanging out some. And
you got a visitor.
We had a hey.
Hi.
I asked my wife Phyllis, say hey.
Hey there.
Hello. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi. How are you?
She builds about 90% of our pedals that we ship out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. All the bigger ones. The bigger ones. The small ones we have built at a factory. But
anyway. Oh, very cool.
During the sound check, you know, of course it was awesome. I mean, Eddie Van Halen's playing through an amp I designed, you know, and he's, you know, they're out there testing and all that stuff, and it's just in the afternoon or whatever, and he said, hey, you want to come out here and try it? You know, I'm like, are you kidding me? So I said, hell yeah, I'll try it. And I went out there, and I put on his guitar, and I'm standing behind the monitors, and I just went, you know, blank. I don't remember what I played. Something lame, I'm sure, in comparison. But you talk about huge. I mean, it was the first time I had ever, of course, done that, even played one chord on a stage like that.
And was it immense? It was immensely loud, I imagine.
It was insane. Mm-hmm. Now, most of that wall of cabinets was dummies and stuff, but he used 3 cabinets at the bottom, right in the center of that wall. So the wall kind of helped the low end a little bit, I think. But the center cabinet would be this dry one, and then he had the H&H cabinets driving the wet cabinets on the sides, and those 3 cabs were mic'd up. But, of course, it's coming
to this
through.
Day.
Yeah, but, of course, it was coming through the monitors. It was coming through the side fills. It's coming out the front of the house. Mm-hmm. So I played this big chord, and it was just huge, you know.
That's amazing.
And then when they started playing, I couldn't sit down. I just walked around out in the crowd, and before they started, I was standing out by the mixer, and all I could see was all those amps with the green and red lights on each one, you know.
Right.
And Dave, I'm sure you've got some experience like that. The first time somebody that mattered played through some of your stuff on a big stage, you know, can you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, sure. Of course.
It was one of the biggest ones.
For me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Who would have been probably the maybe Steve Stevens might have been one. Early adopter
of early one
amps for me. For that particular amp. Earlier than that, before I actually did my own sort of line, I made this other amp called the Naked Amp, and that was Billy Howardell from A Perfect Circle would used that. Oh. Still does to this day. Use that amp, and I made him some custom ones and stuff. And
yeah,
but that wasn't quite on the same large scale. But then again, you know, the funny thing is, I'd been doing rigs for people,
right,
before amps, and I've been doing that really a long time. So I was really used to dealing with artists and dealing with that. And when you're talking about all this era with add-in stuff, I had been to the studio when they were recording. I had seen a prototype PV laying there. Yeah. I had seen, I know that little era.
Yeah.
Oh, so you were working with him at the same time on the rack.
Well, that, no, I didn't do his stuff then. I was friends with Matt Bruck.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And at the time, wow, when was that record done?
Like 90.
Something 90 like or something. So at the time,
90,
I was like 20 years old, or 18, 19, 20 years old. Yeah. And I had worked for Andy Brower Studio Rentals at the time.
Okay.
So I got to go to that studio at the time, working for them. The cabinet that was used on that record, the Marshall 4, there was a Marshall 412 cabinet he was using with a Soldano that was 75 watt. Yeah. Celestians in it. And that cabinet was from Andy Brower's, which he later bought from him.
Yeah. I think we might have
rental because they liked the Soldano. They liked that cabinet with the Soldano. They liked the tone of the speakers with the Soldano, yeah. The cleaner sort of speakers.
The one thing that we did make one fairly big change that we made was he didn't particularly like the 5881s. That were in the Soldanos, and they were using those a lot.
Right.
At the time, now, 5881s were the good 6L6 you could buy. You know what I'm saying? You remember that. And
still to this day, maybe.
Yeah, and you know, the only reason we weren't using that kind of thing was because we still had some Sylvania power tubes left. See, back in the mm-hmm. the late 80s, Hartley, when Sylvania stopped making them, Hartley, they went to all the people who were doing tube amps, and they said, hey, here's your last chance. How many you want? And Hartley was like, okay, I'll take $500,000 worth of them. And wow. Yeah, that's a lot of damn tubes, but he was convinced that if they were stopping, GE power tubes at the time were pretty flaky back then. Now, because there's so few anything, they're probably sought after, but at the time, the Sylvanias were a lot better. And so he bought all those tubes, and we were going through them kind of slow through the VTMs. But when we started shipping 5150s, man, we started running out of tubes pretty quick. And,
right.
But he liked that 6L6 a lot better than the 5881s that I know that were in the their design. And it's a funny story that goes with that tube thing is, you know, like this amp I have is a block letter EVH. It says EVH on the front. A few years into it, we changed it to his signature on the front. And everybody swears that the block letter is better and it's a different circuit and that we tweaked it and made a bunch of changes and all that kind of stuff. But what happened is when we were building those block letters, Electrovoice sent us a letter and said, hey, you can't put EV something on your products because that's confusing to the marketplace because all their speakers at that time were EVLs and EVMs and all this stuff. And, you know, I'm sure that if you wanted to spend 20 or 30 grand, we could have fought it and they would have, you know, backed out. But instead, Hartley told Eddie, look, let's not throw away a bunch of money on this. Let's just change it. Put your signature on the front. So that's what we did. Well, it turns out, at that same time, we were running out of those power tubes. So right when the signature changed, we ran out of Sylvania power tubes, and I had to switch to like a Chinese 6L6 at that point.
So that's the tone change.
So that's the difference. We didn't change anything about it, transformers, parts, nothing. The only thing that changed was the power tubes. We ran out of those other power tubes. So, you know.
And how much?
That makes sense.
How much of a tone change is that? Did it really make?
Well, it can be enough. A big deal. It can be a big deal. It can be, you know, to me, the that Chinese power tube I found was the closest thing out there to it, but it's still a little bit different, you know? So, you know, so that was the deal with the block letter change. It really wasn't any change, but it's still kind of, and when we changed it, I told him, I said, you know, this is going to be a legend. This is going to be one of those legendary things, you know, that when they changed the block letter, everything, you know, the whole sound changed or whatever.
And it is actually, so, it still has that, you know, that
it is
mysterious. It's yeah. It's funny. Sorry, James, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to segue into something else. So I don't want to change the train of thought.
Do it.
Okay. All right. So we have a giveaway tonight.
I'm going to bow out for just a second and go, this beer is defective. I'll be right back.
I have a different problem, so I'm going to bow out too.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
All right. Well, I'm going to need you, Dave, to help me when you get back.
Okay.
Okay.
Hang on 1 second then. You can talk about it.
I'll talk about it.
Okay.
All right. I'm all alone now. All right. So tonight we're giving away this pedal. This is the J Rocket Audio Boing pedal. And we're also going to be giving away the Friedman Bucks and Boots pedal. So this is the Boing pedal, as you can see, from J Rocket Audio. So what we're going to do is I have two trivia questions that we're going to ask. I'm going to ask the first one now for the J Rocket pedal, and then we'll give away the Bucks and Boots pedal. So the first question that we've got, and the first person to answer it correctly will win this, okay? So first person to answer it in the chat, all right? So I'm in the chat. Let me get there right now. Someone says the answer is the Village People. No, that's not. Although I won't go there. All right. All right, you guys ready? You guys ready to win the J Rocket audio pedal? All right. Here we go. This is from episode one. What famous guitarist did Grover Jackson go to see at the Hyatt House or the Riot House Hotel to show off some vintage guitars? What famous guitarist did Grover Jackson go to see at the Hyatt House, the Riot House Hotel to show off some vintage guitars? This is from episode one. And I believe Richard Basinger, recording artist engineer, said Jimmy Page first. So I believe that is it. But I'm going to look. Let's give it a second. But I think Richard J. Basinger is the winner. But I'll need Dave to confirm that for me.
Okay, what are we confirming? what did you ask?
I asked the first trivia question for the J Rocket audio pedal.
Okay. Right,
which was, what famous guitarist did Grover Jackson go see at the Hyatt House, the Riot House Hotel, to show off some vintage guitars from episode one? And I believe I captured that it was Richard Basinger, recording artist engineer, Jimmy Page, he answered. And he was the first one. If you can confirm that for me.
I'm looking right now.
Okay.
I'm just slowly going back here.
In this internet age, how do you even do trivia online? I mean, how fast can somebody look something up like that? Bam.
That's true. I mean,
they did have to watch a 4-hour show.
Yeah, they had to watch. This was a story from Grover that I don't necessarily know was out there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, this was from our first episode.
Okay, ready.
I
think that's it. Yeah, Richard J.
Okay, Jim Becker, and then it was Richard J. Basinger, a recording artist, engineer, Jimmy Page. All right, Richard, send me an email, which is tonetalkmark@gmail.com. Tonetalkmark@gmail.com, or reach out to me on Facebook. Give me your address, let me know where you're at, and I will get this out to you. Hopefully you don't live in like Indonesia or something like that. I hope you're somewhere close, and I'll get this out to you. All right. All right. Let's move back to James. And that was awesome. Thanks guys for the trivia there. And,
we got another giveaway that we'll be doing in a little while.
Yeah. We'll move on and then we'll do the next one for the Bucks and Boost. And Dave, you'll get that one out to the guest or to the winner. Mm-hmm. All right. Sorry, James, for that little segue. All right.
He was curing his defective beer.
This one's a lot better.
Good.
I have to drink these skinny beers because when you get old, you can't drink those heavy ones anymore.
Well, or when you get the skinny ones, it makes you feel skinnier.
Yeah, doesn't work.
Doesn't work. You just wind up drinking more of the skinny
exactly.
ones.
Exactly.
That's funny.
It's just like eating little small sandwiches, you know, at a party. You just fill your plate up with them.
Right. It doesn't change the amount.
Yeah.
Right.
That's funny. So, all right. So now, you talked about, you know, the Ed stuff and the amp and the change in tone and with the tubes and stuff from the block letter. And I told you the other day, I have the combo.
Oh yeah. So, right.
And the combo
is like 150 pounds.
At least. Yeah, it's heavy. It's a heavy thing now. It's not your average 60 watt combo. That's for sure.
No. So tell me, how did that come about?
Well, you know, it was like I was saying earlier, he was kind of big on that whole thing where a kid could go to the music store and buy something and get the kind of sound he was getting. That was like a big deal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even though our manufacturing techniques allowed us to build a head that was just over $1,000, something like that at the time, by the time you add a 412, even one 412 to it, you know, you're going to spend close to $2,000. That's a lot of money for a kid. So it was, you know, he thought, well, why don't we try to do a combo version and just cut everything in half? He was using one head with 412s, and that was like the magic. And so we built a 60 watt version of the head, just swapped the transformers out to some that we had that was 60 and pulled two tubes out of it, you know, the whole nine yards. And then we built it on, it was just like a head sitting on top of a cabinet. It was a straight 212 with the head right on top of it. It looked just like a head in the 212 cabinet. And and he loved it. It sounded great, but it looked goofy. I mean, it really didn't look like a combo. So we were like, well, this is kind of big anyway. Why don't we go for like a Vox sort of look with the knobs on the back, you know? And that made sense. So we redid it and built it a little bit taller and put the knobs on the back, and we put a reverb in it because most guys that use combos like that. And then I started the process again, you know, the send it out there and then go back and forth and tweak it over and over. Mm-hmm. And I'm out there tweaking it one time and we were struggling because, you know, he was used to playing that 100 watt loudness, you know, the volume of 100 watt and 60 watts with 212s. This is not even close to as loud. So he kept turning it up more than he would normally set it. You know, even though anybody that's ever played a 5150 knows that it's extremely loud and it comes up real fast on the master. You don't have to turn it up but halfway and you're hitting the power amp good, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't get louder after a certain point.
And you know, that as an aside, that was something I tried to fix on a prototype one time. I built the first one with a linear pot right there. And it just came up way too fast. You couldn't even think about playing it in your house. The next one, I changed it to an audio taper, you know, so it would come up a little slower and you could still crank it, you know. And he called me, he's like, man, this thing's just not right. It doesn't sound anything like that other one. And I said, oh, well, I just changed the pot on there to an audio taper. So you just need to turn it up a little more. He said, why? That's not right. And I said, well, I changed the pot so you could come up slower so a guy could actually play it in his bedroom and get a decent, you know, he'd be able to get a low volume. He said, well, it ain't no practice amp. So I said, okay, fine. I changed it back, you know, and that's why that thing, when you turn it up, man, you get it to about even 9 o'clock and it's starting to kill you, you know. But halfway, you're definitely hitting the power amp and clipping it pretty good.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, awesome. but anyway, that on the 60 watt, he was turning it even further to try to get it as loud as he was used to. And it was very, by that time, you can imagine it's starting to get kind of farty and the attack is loose feeling because you're so loud, you know, you're cranking it so much. And so, and we were struggling with it. And I started tweaking some things that I had done on some other amps. And I started tweaking the tightness, basically, of the attack at the front end of the circuit. And I made a couple of value changes. And he's like, oh, what'd you just do? And I'm like, well, you said you wanted to be a little tighter. So I changed the low end and the front end so it would be a little bit chunkier, you know, a little tighter. And he said, well, that's the problem there. It's perfect now. He said, why didn't you ever tell me that before? And I said, well, hell, once you said it was awesome, the last thing I was going to do is screw around with it anymore. You know, everybody was happy. We were finally done. So I wasn't going to go back to the drawing board at that point, you know, start, hey, you want to adjust this a little bit? So
right, you're like, all right, it's good.
Yeah, that's it.
Hey,
so, so I'd actually built that combo circuit. It's just about three values difference in the lead channel, and we built I took one of his heads and made the same change to it, and that's the head he used on the balance tour. It was that same modified head, and that preamp structure, all the rest of the 5150s since have had that adjustment to them. So the first 5150 is different from all the rest. In other words, that attack, that feeling, the first one is thicker and a little buzzier. From the combo, the two, the three, all the fender stuff, all that has that tighter, chunkier attack.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, then from then on, I got guys all the time emailing me, hey, how can I change this 5152 lead channel to sound like the original? You know, and it's a pretty easy mod. It's just three parts, you know, that you change.
Mm-hmm.
And basically changing the amount of low end going through the stages so that it can chunk tighter. It helps the mids kind of punch through is basically what it does, instead of the low end masking everything when it distorts.
Interesting.
You know?
Now, we have a question here from the chat. From Richard Boyer. So there's a story about a birch cab that Ed could hear the difference between the different types of wood.
And he was, you know, that's when we were doing the first amp, you know, we had our 412 cabinet we built, and it was just regular old poplar plywood. And because, I mean, birch plywood with those little tiny plies in there is expensive. It's not, I'll be honest with you. We're sitting here trying to build something that a kid could buy. And so we were using the wood that we normally used for 412. And he sent us one of his 412s, and we got to looking at it. And sure enough, you know, the story, a lot of those old Marshalls, they're just, it's birch plywood, and there's a lot of grain. There's a lot of thin plies in there. So it's very rigid because of all those little thin pieces of wood. It's glued up real tight. And that has a lot to do with the sound of the cabinet. And believe it or not, at that point, we were, you know, he could hear the difference. And anybody that's back then, we were kind of surprised by that. But as time goes by, you know, we start figuring out these things and experimenting with different things. And you know, come to find out that birch plywood made a huge difference.
No, it makes a massive difference.
Yeah. It's just a lot tighter. Now, if you take that same cabinet, same everything about it, same speaker, same amp, and you build that out of regular old, you know, like a five ply or something, plywood that's just poplar, like you'd buy at the hardware store to build a wall or something. Mm-hmm. If you use that, what'll happen is you get a lot more woofy low end. It won't, the notes won't stop. They won't go chunk like a hammer.
They're not punchy. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't punch and it doesn't go chunk like that. It kind of, it goes kind of like if you turn the resonance control way up. You know, you turn it way up, the amp lets the speaker flop more because you're adjusting the damping factor to a lower setting. And that lets the, it, it, the amp no longer controls the speaker and keeps it from moving. You know, that's what that resonance control is, adjusting the damping factor of the cabinet, mm-hmm. of the amp, rather, mm-hmm. and how the amp can control the speaker. It's kind of like having a bad shock absorber. When it's set high, it's like the shock absorber's real crappy. And when you hit it, it goes boo, like that. You turn it down, and it's like having a real good shock absorber. When you hit it, it goes boom. And it doesn't, it just pops right back, you know. That's what that resonance control does. And that cabinet made a big difference in how tight that would actually sound, you know, whether it would he used the term, he would talk about it sounding like a hammer, like you're hitting something with a hammer, mm-hmm. you know, and specifically in the old days, he would talk about trying to give it a snare sound, like the sound of when Alex would hit the snare, it would go, ka, you know, it'd have like a tight. a sharpness to it or something. So that was the deal with that cabinet. And, you know, hell, we even put the screw holes exactly where they were on his old cabinet that he liked so much. I mean, mm-hmm. they weren't exactly right. So, we measured them off and put them exactly where they needed to be, mm-hmm. you know.
That's funny.
And spent a lot of time developing the speakers as well. You know, that was a PV-made speaker in those cabinets.
Oh, yeah.
The Sheffields.
I've got a 4x12 in my garage with the original Sheffields. And of course, you know, the combo too. They sound great.
You know, Mueller makes the cones that Celestion used at the time. I'm sure I don't know how all that's changed over the years. It may still be them, but
mm-hmm. I think so.
But anyway, that we, you know, PV bought the same parts, just the Mueller cones and stuff. And we wound our own voice coils and stuff, and we used Nomex on the voice coil formers. And I didn't specifically work on the transducer side, but I became like the translator. I was the guy that had figured out the language, and I could talk to him easier than most everybody else. So I'd get involved in these things, you know. When my buddy Jim DeCola started doing the Wolfgang design, I worked with him a little bit and stuff, and I would end up in some of the communication part of that to try to help him, you know, describe what he means when he says this or that, you know, that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. So, was the combo made of birch also?
Yep. Sure was.
That explains why it's
why it weighs so much.
That wood is, well, you think about one thing is when you put that many little bitty plies, you also have that many layers of glue, and glue is heavier than wood. So a piece of birch plywood with like 11 plies or whatever, it's
11 ply, 5/8 thick, or
right.
goes by millimeters most of the time. But
yeah, it's like 15 millimeters, which is
15 millimeter. Yeah. And that's what we use.
I mean, it's how you build a guitar cabinet if you want it to have that old Marshall-y kind of growl to the cabinet. And, you know, I'll be honest, at that time, we didn't really know that the cabinet was that critical. Most everybody at PV used the PA speaker kind of philosophies when it came to guitar cabinets. And we kind of learned as we went along how important it was, how the baffle was attached, whether the sides of the cabinet were rigid or whether they could move, kind of like an acoustic guitar, you know, all that kind of stuff matters.
We had a question also, and I probably missed who it was, but it was a good question about how involved was Hartley in the process of all this stuff? And what, someone asked, was he a good guy to deal with?
You know, I learned the two most important people at Peavey, as far as what I learned, were Jack Sondermeyer, who was my boss, and Hartley Peavey. And, you know, Hartley learned this stuff. He learned it. A lot of the stuff he learned was like he did circuit board layouts back in the 70s. He would do them himself with hand tape and stuff like that. And he and Jack had worked together on a lot of that stuff. So he knew a lot of it. He knew a lot about what went on in the industry and things. When we did, by the time I got there, he had gotten out of a lot of the design work, but he was constantly throwing little, you know, scratching out schematic ideas and stuff of, and I always made fun of him and told him that shit wouldn't work. And, you know, but a lot of times they would have a lot of merit. You know, it would be some idea he'd come up with that was at least close to something that you could do that would work real well. You know, for example, those classic amps that we did about the same time as a 5150, that was the original schematic. Hartley sketched it out on a napkin basically and handed it to me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a whole lot of confidence in it because I was trying to make amps that had more gain because that's what most people wanted. But of course there's a ton of people that didn't want that. They just wanted a nice sounding clean amp, mm-hmm. you know, and he sketched something out and I did something similar to it and changed a few things about it that weren't practical, but you know, but now on the 5150, I'll give you an example of something that was his deal was even something as little as the look of it, you know, the amp has the logos and stuff behind that metal grill. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody else has ever done that since or before. It's just kind of a little quirky thing. Hey, why don't we put it behind the grill? So it's just kind of 3D or whatever. That was his idea. Mm-hmm. You know, at the time we just had the metal grill and he stuck the stuff on front and it just looked like it looked. And he said, well, why don't you try putting it behind the grill? And you'll still be able to read it because the grill is kind of open, you know. And sure enough, it works cool, and it's just a unique look. I don't know if they're still using that look on the EVH brand, but that was an example of a contribution.
No, on the EVH, they got a logo that's planted right there.
On the front.
On the front, yeah, it's screwed in.
See, so
yep.
They blew it. They blew the whole look.
No, it's over now. Yeah, that's fine.
I'm just teasing, of course.
That's cool. I was curious. So, did it have anything to do with maybe saving in costs, or no? It was just his idea that would look cool.
No, it didn't have any bearing on the. I suppose maybe it's a little cheaper because you don't have to try to figure out a way to mount the logos on the grill. You just screw them into the wood. That wood panel had a vinyl coating on the front, kind of like you do on a little sort of like what they use on equipment, flight cases and stuff, mm-hmm. but it was a thinner piece of vinyl than that. And so we just wood screwed the logos on the front of that. And, I always thought it was kind of a cool thing, you know, just something. It's neat when you do something different and it's unique. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing Hartley hated the silver faceplate. And the reason is his reason was because when Fender, everybody knows the black faces were the awesome Fenders. Mm-hmm. And when you went to the silver ones, they weren't as cool. So he just always felt like using that silver was sort of a detriment, you know, that it would have been cooler to have a black face. But, you know, that's in this case, it's apples and oranges. So,
yeah, totally.
And,
so that's cool. So then you worked with Ed till 2003?
Four. 2000. Yeah, I was there from 86 to 2004. And, you know, and we did the combo. We did the 5152, which was the little bit, the step up that had, you know, separate EQ on the two channels and everything. And then later on, we started working on a little mini stack. And basically, I took the preamp design and I did a 40-watt version of the head. in a little bitty box about, you know, probably about that, like maybe 20 inches at most wide, just a little bitty head. Mm-hmm. Probably about like those ones that you're doing, Dave, something like that. Maybe maybe a tiny bit smaller than that, because we used sort of a hybrid approach. Since it had an effects loop, I went ahead and put some op-amp stuff right there where that was.
Yeah.
You know, and so the last thing I was working on with him was that.
And you mean like something like this size?
Yeah, about like that. And we did and of course it looked just like the big head. It was the same as a 5152, except tiny. And it was a pretty cool head, you know. And then we built a 112 cabinet to go with it, and two of them stacked up. So it was a lot of people didn't have a whole lot of faith in it selling, because it was more like something a kid would use, but yet it was all tubes. So it was going to cost $1,500, you know, by the time you did all that.
Uh-huh. Right.
And, but that was the last thing I worked on with him. And actually, the last time I saw him was at his house. We were working on that. It was probably 2003. It might have been, I think it was 2003 or two. But anyway, we were working on that and trying to tweak some things about it. And it was kind of a dark time. He was having a real hard time with the cancer and things with his mouth and stuff. But after that, I left Peavey in 2004, which was not too long after that. And I think, and as I recall, he left sometime that year as well, and went on and started his own thing with the Fender EVH brand, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know when that started, but I think
and happily for all of us, he kind of got a lot healthier after that.
Oh yeah.
You know, and now he looks like he's in pretty good shape. So I'm happy to see that, you know, but I hadn't actually seen him in a while. I know, Dave, you've had some dealings with him in the last 10 years.
Oh yeah. I started dealing with him that very last, maybe it was around 2004. Mark, maybe, you know, when was that kind of horrible Sammy tour, the last one?
That was 2004.
Yeah, it was 2004. So I started doing, in fact, I think I've seen that amp you're talking about, by the way, around that time.
The little mini stack.
Little one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I started doing rigs for him before that tour.
So that was after the 3 album?
Yes.
Exactly. They were doing Sammy was back or whatever.
Yeah, Sammy was back, and they did that tour. That was a time too for him. So
yeah, that was not a good tour. Yeah,
that wasn't.
I remember.
Yeah, so
I actually enjoyed that Gary Cherone tour. That I know a lot of people don't give that album a whole lot of kudos, but as far as tours go. Gary sounded great.
Yeah, he sounded great doing the old stuff.
Well, that was part of it, I think. I grew up when the first album hit. So when Gary hit, when Gary was all about that, he was like, yeah, I'll sing Dave's stuff. Cool. Right. So when I saw him in Dallas, and he was singing, and they were doing a lot of the old stuff, and it gave me chills, you know, to hear that stuff again. And to be kind of caught, to be part of it too, you know, I mean,
oh, of course,
you know, I'm not a genius or nothing, and I didn't like invent anything, but I got to work with Eddie Van Halen on some amps, and that was kind of cool. You know what I'm saying? That's how I look at it. It was like, you know, I feel like that was a cool connection to have, at least.
So then kind of segueing past that, I mean, you did the classic series, right?
Yep, I did the classic series at PV. Which
I think the classic series is great. It's a great workhorse little amp.
I get a lot of people, probably just as many people, bring those up, like the Classic 30, as people do the 5150. Classic 30 was big, you know, for us. That,
I had one for a long time, just as a bench amp, you know, to test things through and stuff. And And man, that thing sounded great. I might have replaced the speaker or something in it, but it really sounded great. Got quite a bit of gain out of it, and you know.
Yeah, it had a moderate. It was certainly in the Marshall-y range of gain.
Yeah.
But it was tight. It wasn't like the normal input of a Marshall where it's a little bit on the flubby feel, you know.
Yeah.
I tried to make that stuff to where it would chunk a little bit, you know, even though it didn't have a ton of gain. And, you know, although a lot of the people that use those just played them clean and cranked them up some, you know, because that was the deal.
Mm-hmm.
I get beat up all the time by Tex about that Classic 30, though, because the way we built it, it's got a...
Oh, how it goes together?
It's you know what it was? Hartley wanted it to be...
Service nightmare.
Yeah, he wanted it to be $299. That's cheap, man, back in 90,
yeah.
90 or so. And so I tried, you know, and there wasn't any, you know, those tube sockets that have the... that you solder them and the socket goes out the bottom. That shit didn't exist back then. So we wanted it to be all wave soldered. So I did it with two boards like that, pots up here, tube sockets down here. And I had all kind of problems with the, I couldn't put the cathode parts with the tube. I had to put them up here and it was a nightmare. So I was like, all right, well, how about if I put a board between those two? So I had three boards with jumper cables between them, and it's all folded up. And, man, those guys beat me up. I've been getting beat up for years over that design. But you know what?
To take that apart is a nightmare.
It sucks. I know it sucked. But you gotta give me credit, though. I made a damn amp that was $299. You know what I'm saying?
And it sounded good, too.
It sounds good. It sounds good. It does what it's supposed to do. It's got effects loop, two channels, reverb, all that crap. And it's...
Mm-hmm. Was it built in the USA, too, for $299?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Yeah,
there you go.
Right there in Meridian, Mississippi.
Yep.
So, that's, I mean, I don't think they are now, but... For many years, they were built there, and it was.
I think they go for more money used now than that.
That's right, they do.
I think it's now, like $500 or something, $600.
Yeah.
And but they're still making the Classic series, though, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they. I kind of think maybe they make them in China now, but
right.
I don't think they build. I know they build that new. Invective amp here, but I'm not sure about the other stuff. I haven't really been paying that much attention to it because I've been too busy, you know, building pedals and stuff. Right.
Well, let's make a segue there. Tell us about, you know, your,
well, wait, one more thing people want to know about is the JSX amp.
Okay. I was going to jump around, but sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Talk about JSX, you know, before the JSX was the Triple X.
Right.
And the Triple X came from the Triumph Ultra, Ultra Plus, Ultra, and then the Triple X. That series of amps was the amp that I, you know, we started out trying to do something in that old-time boogie kind of a range, you know, the Mark IV sort of an amp that had that kind of gain. And I made sure that they had more independence between channels. You know how the Mark IVs have a lot of, you turn this knob and now this other channel's weird. You know what I mean? Yep. Everything's interconnected, which is fine. I mean, that's their deal. I tried to do a bunch of independence and stuff on there. And by the time I got to the Ultra Plus, it was getting to be pretty popular with people. It was a high gain amp that still had a good clean channel and everything. And we had, George Lynch came to us and we were working with him on it. He liked it and he liked the Ultra and we decided to tweak it and make it more like what he wanted it to do for the lead and the crunch channel and stuff. And that was the Triple X. I tweaked that to suit George. For whatever reason, it didn't pan out with him business wise or whatever. And we moved on. And Joe had been using our stuff a little bit. He had a 5150 and a Classic 50 he liked, and he wanted us to make him a signature amp. And so he liked the Triple X. He liked the Classic 50. So I took the Classic 50. I took the Triple X and I changed the second channel. I redid the second channel so it sounded like a Classic 50, even though it had that active EQ. You know that the Triple X has an active EQ for the lead channel, 3-band active. It's kind of an unusual EQ, really, for all the other amps compared to most amps out there that have a regular passive EQ. And I tweaked that so that it sounded like the crunch of the Classic 50 and the clean channel. Now, working with Joe, he toured for a while with that modified Triple X. And what he'd do is he would, you know, we'd talk about some tweak or something, and he would, I'd make a change, send it to him. And then I had another amp, and if he wanted something different, I'd put a switch on there or something. Here's an A or a B. You tell me which one you like. And I'd send him that one. He'd send me the other one back. And so we literally just did like that a few times. And it was the easiest process of designing an amp I've ever done. With Eddie, if he wanted me to try something else, I'd have to basically build another prototype from scratch and send it to him. He didn't send anything back. But with Joe, I could send something with a switch on there to help, so he could help me decide things, you know, A or B. Is this better or is that? You know, it's kind of like the eye doctor, you know.
Right.
One or two. and Joe was real good about working scientifically like that, you know. And it's kind of, maybe it's ironic, but the last tweak that we made on his amp was also in Atlanta. And we came out here to a show. It was a G3 thing with it's pretty cool. It was him and Steve Vai and Yngwie Malmsteen. Mm-hmm. And that guy is like if a truck driver from Texas had a British accent, that'd be that guy. That's what he's like. He's so funny because of just, you know, his ways and stuff. He was kicking picks out in the audience and all that stuff.
Yeah, he's a character.
But yeah, that picture, there's a picture on my site of me and Joe and Bill Xavier, who was our product manager. He and I worked a lot together on these projects in the late 90s, early 2000s. And we were at that show in Atlanta, and I made a couple of little minor adjustments, you know, to the final head before we started building the production ones. And that was like the last project I worked on at Peavey was that JSX. You know, and it was a pretty cool amp, and I think, I don't know exactly what their newest, they've got like a 3120 or something like that, and I think it may be something to do with the Triple X and the JSX. I don't know, you know, exactly how all that ended up, but they still, you know, a lot of people still dig that amp as well.
Mm-hmm. Now Joe left pretty abruptly, if I remember.
Yeah, I really don't know because when I left in 04, we were just putting it into production. And I know they made some changes after that. My buddy John Fields, who's the engineer that worked with me for the last 5 or 8 years, something like that at Peavey, he made a bunch of tweaks to that at the last minute before they started shipping them. But yeah, I don't know the situation after that because I had left and to go to work for Custom up in Cincinnati.
Right. So tell us about that. So you were the head engineer there, right?
Yeah. When I left Peavey, I was the head engineer over instrument amps. And my boss, Jack Sonnemeyer, had retired by then. And I took over the department, and my kids were starting to get in college age and stuff, and I kind of needed a change, you know, how things go. And so I got this opportunity to work at Custom, and they're in Cincinnati, which scared the hell out of me to move to Ohio. I'm from Mississippi, you know, so that's like up north somewhere. And But you know what? It was the nicest people. There were. I was very happy. I enjoyed working with them, and I got to work on a lot of cool stuff. You know, one of the first things I did up there is an amp called the Coop, and basically I took a. In fact, there's one of them right there. See that red top amp?
Yep.
That's a Coop, and basically we. You know, in the old days, Custom had the tuck and roll, the full pleated tuck and roll stuff like Fogarty used to use. And I did this amp, which is kind of like more of a Vox-shaped thing, but with the front, just that little bit of tuck and roll along the top edge, you know, trying to do something a little bit like that. But it's all birch plywood, and, you know, and I did, and they said, do the amp. You always wanted to do it Peavey. And it's like, well, then it's going to be birch plywood, and it's going to be, and I'm going to put as many tubes in there as I need to, you know, to get the gain that I want. And that was kind of a fun project.
That's cool.
I ended up doing that. And then I did a head called the Double Cross before I left Custom. And then in 2009, I started Amp Tweaker. And, which is what I've been doing ever since then. It's my own company, and we do pedals. You know, I just came out with a speaker this week. It's kind of cool. Let me show you that.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, show it.
It looks just like a speaker. See? It's like, here's the label on the back. That's my brand, Amp Tweaker. And basically, I've been working with WGS in Kentucky. They do some work for us, and they make their own speakers as well. So I started saying, well, you know, I've been doing speakers my whole life. I designed the speaker in the Custom amp and several different speakers at Peavey. And so I wanted to make a speaker that you could get the Celestian-y, growly, Marshall-y, if you will, sound, but still be able to get a good clean sound out of it. Because that's kind of tricky, if you know what I mean. A lot of times the American clean sound, they usually have like a seamed cone. It'll be flat, and it'll have like a seam in there, and a lot of times they'll be kind of raspy sounding. And so what we did is we combined some various ingredients and tricks and stuff and came out with this. And basically you can – it's sort of like in between. You know, you can get the good – Marshall-y, if you want to call it that, Celestian-y kind of sounds out of it when you play dirty. But when you play clean, you still get the bright and rich bottom end that you get out of a regular, like a Fender speaker. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of something new that we just started doing, you know, recently, this week, literally.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a cool idea.
You know, it's like my brand name is Amp Tweaker, and I used to call myself that on Harmony Central and stuff like those forums and stuff. And the reason is because I'm not like a engineering genius or any of that kind of stuff. I just, what I do is I tweak stuff, and I learned over the years what guys wanted and how to communicate with them. I mean, you got to admit, Dave, that's one of the hardest things is just to figure out what the guy means when he says.
Yeah. Understand what he's saying. Things.
It's mm-hmm. It can be tough. There is a language to it, though, and you learn it over time. You get to where you can, you know, figure out when they say thick or tight or chunky or whatever, what that stuff means and what you should do to accommodate that. So,
yeah, know. Exactly. And there's many things you can do to accommodate some of those requests.
Right.
And so do I make it tighter in the preamp? Do I make it tighter in the power amp? Do I make it...
Right. And it depends on how they're playing it and what kinds of things they're going for, really.
So tell us more about the products that you have at Amp Tweaker. So I know you've got the Tight Metal, right?
Yeah, that's kind of our flagship, the Tight Metal stuff. You know, when I started Amp Tweaker in 2009, my main goal was to get back to working with artists and consumers directly. you know, at Custom, at towards the end at Peavey, and also at Custom, I got to where we were doing a lot of things for big companies like Guitar Center and Musician's Friend and all these various dealers and stuff. And we'd make stuff they wanted us to do. It's kind of like a bunch of 50-year-olds sitting around arguing about what kids want to buy. You know what I mean? And I told myself, you know, I'd love to get back to the way we used to do it, where we just listen to the consumer and ask them what they want. Mm. Just talk to them directly. You know, people will tell you in 2 seconds what they want if you ask them. And especially nowadays, we got all these internet methods for communicating with the consumers and finding out what's not working and what is, and, you know, learning what they're doing differently. Mm. So I started, for the first 6 months, all my website was a red button about that big that said product suggestions. And I had people sending in ideas and stuff, you know. And a lot of the things on our products came from that. For example, the tight knob. You know, I was telling you a minute ago about the 5150, how I adjusted that tightness. Mm-hmm. And Eddie was like, wow, I didn't know you could do that. Well, that's one of the most important things, it turns out. But from one guy to the next, some people like it to smush a little when you push the notes hard with your guitar, when you palm mute it and you hit it. Some guys don't want it to go chunk. They want it to go plum a little bit, or just kind of smush a little, you know. And a lot of amp guys will design their amp to be what they think is the perfect mode of that. And a lot of times it doesn't work that well, you know, for everybody. When I did the Joe Satriani amp, the Triple X was real tight and chunky. Mm. And Joe was like, can you make it not so tight and chunky? But it's just not, you know, sometimes I just want it to be a little bit more, you know, he plays with a lot of legato style, where you're hammering on and stuff a lot, and you know, you need a little thickness on the bottom end for that to work. Mm. So I ended up putting a fat switch on there that kicked in a little bit of different low end just for that purpose, so that it would sing a little better. And so when I did my first pedals, that was one of the things I did, was figure out a way to do that on a knob so you could dial it right where you wanted it, you know. Mm. The tight control. And most all of our products are that way. You know, I'll do two or three things, and then people will say, hey, can you put this and this together and add this feature to it or whatever. You know, probably one of the coolest things that we've done, I'll just show you on this half built pedal here. See this thing called Sidetrack?
Yeah.
What that is an extra loop on the side of the pedal. And I had this guy, I built him a tight drive, one of my first pedals, overdrive pedal. And he was like, you know, this thing's awesome. He said, the only problem is you got this loop on the back. I put loops on the back of all my pedals so you can patch delays in with it or whatever you want. So you hit the switch and whatever's back there comes on with it. You can build your own little combination thing, so you don't have to hit two switches at once, you know.
That's cool.
And he said, and that was real popular. But then he said, you know, sometimes when I use a compressor, I don't want, when I kick on the distortion, I wish the compressor would go off and not have to hit two things, you know. So what this does, I came up with that loop for him. This loop comes on when the pedal's off, and the back one comes on when it's on. So if you want like this drive to add a delay, you patch a delay in back here. And then whatever you like for your clean sound, you put it in here, and this thing will turn it off when you kick the distortion on.
That's a good idea.
See what I mean?
That's cool.
It's called, and that little thing is one of our most popular features that we have on our products, is that sidetrack loop. Because it just makes it easy. You don't have to have a bunch of looper switchboard crap and all this. You just patch your clean crap in here, your lead stuff in here, and you hit that one switch and you go between the two.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, so we've been focusing on things like that, you know, trying to people are coming up, somebody will send in a cool idea and we'll try to figure out a way to implement it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people make suggestions that aren't exactly what we need to do, but the suggestion will make me realize some other thing that we can do that'll accomplish that and some other things, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, the triple X, the tight metal and the fat metal, those came from the 5150 in a way. I was working with this metal guy, Mark Kleppel, who works with the band Misery Index. And all those death metal guys use 5150s, the old ones, or they use a VH140C Ampeg. And that VH140C is a solid-state amp that they just all particularly like. It's real tight and chunky feeling. So the notes stop, you know, real fast.
Mm.
So I borrowed one of those amps, and he told me his settings, and I set up the amp that way, and I curved it, and I was like, man, that looks familiar. And so I took my 5150 and set it on Eddie's settings, the particular settings he liked, and the curve laid right on top of the other one. It was like serendipity, you know. Why would all the death metal guys be, and it was a different knob setting. It wasn't like, you know, turning the mids all the way down and the highs up or nothing weird like that. It was just different settings. So by doing that, I figured out that this is a basic curve that works not only for Eddie Van Halen, but for these death metal guys. It's this particular curve.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that curve and that gain structure and I built the pedal to have that. So that when you first turn it on, it just automatically has that, you know, a lot of the metal pedals and stuff, they'll have a whole bunch of knobs so you can get all these different variations of not good sound. and so what I did instead is I just built in that curve that's right and a little bit of tone and stuff so that you can't get too far from what you need, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that tight metal pedal sounds amazing.
I appreciate it.
That's a good one.
Yeah, we have a lot of guys who tour with those, and they'll just take that and take the output and plug it right into a power amp, you know, or they'll go to, you know, a lot of the metal bands, they'll 10 of them will show up at one show and they're all playing whatever the back line is. Mm-hmm. So they'll plug this into the effects return and just bypass the amp preamp and they don't have to worry about whether it feels right or not.
Right. You know? Right.
Most all of those higher gain pedals we do have noise gates built in. So you don't have to turn on a noise gate with it. It comes on with it. And that's kind of another secret that a lot of the metal guys use is they'll use a gate to give you that Pro Tools sound, you know, where the notes just chop right off to quiet.
Yep.
And so we built that in and stuff. And that's pretty much where what's been really popular with our products is the tight metals, any of the metal products. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got a whole ton of pedals now.
Yeah, I've done some fuzz pedals and stuff. I've got a tight fuzz. It's pretty popular. It's kind of unique because it's not like any particular fuzz from the old days. It's like all of them, and you can sort of dial it in and get all these different fuzz sounds out of it. Mm. But it has my tight control in the front, so you can make it not so, you know, how fuzzes have that kind of sloppy feel to them. You can dial that out a little bit and make it a little bit more chunky. I used the word chunky a lot because that's my favorite. That's what I want. When I hit that note and I palm mute it and I stop, I want that joker to stop, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want it to sound like thunk or flunk or, you know, whatever. I want it to go chunk. I want a ch on the front and a k at the end, chunk, and the note stops. It's like kind of like my pet peeve is how that stuff feels.
Yeah. Know?
Right, right.
And it is a feel thing too, but.
Yeah,
but
especially for high gain stuff. You know, lower gain amps, you can adjust some of that, you know, it's not quite as specific. But when you go for real high gain, you can really get in left field if the attack's not exactly right. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Hey, we have a question, James, and let's see. They wanted to know. Fast Eddie VH wanted to know what Eddie's settings were. So I would say just go on Google and just look up Eddie Van Halen PV 5150 settings. And
well, I can tell it to you real quick.
All right, let's go for it. Why not?
On the lead channel, at least, it was 6.5 on the pregame, and then 6 on the bass. The mid was always like 9 o'clock. The high was straight up. The master volume was straight up, which is way too loud for a human. The resonance was almost always on about 4, which is like 10 or 11 o'clock. So it's still pretty tight. And then the presence control generally was on about 6 or 7. So, and if you set it like that, you still won't sound like Eddie Van Halen. But you'll be close.
Well, at least the amp will sound like Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The mids were backed off to like 9 o'clock, you said?
9 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That was generally where he would set it. You know, back in the day, you know, I mean, obviously there's always some tweak for every show, every venue and stuff, but that was the basic settings that we used to talk about all the time.
Right.
I can confirm that. I know that to be true also.
That same setting pretty much, isn't it?
Yep.
Now, I don't know how that conflates with the EVH brand because obviously I wasn't involved in those, but, you know, I've heard that some most of that stuff they tried to maintain the same thing, you know.
So yeah, that's Howard.
It doesn't
Howard
like mid range.
Yeah, and you got to think about it too. We were like I was telling you about the super lead. You crank that super lead up all the way. You got some mids. You know, you play it through that 1/4-12. Mm-hmm. It's mid rangey. It's very mid rangey. And it sounds great, and it's got that feel and stuff. But then you take that and you notch those mids out at the board, and then you get more like what the 5150 sounds. So we were really kind of doing, if you think about it, is we were sort of building that Super Lead 100 sound and the EQ at the board into the preamp of this amp. You see what I'm saying? So you get the same kind of gain structure that the Super Lead had when it was cranked up, and the same kind of EQ that you get basically when he would EQ it at the mixer. Because I know they didn't have to EQ it as much when they used the 5150 for that stuff. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Cool. We got a question for Dave, and I'm sure that this could apply for James as well. From Islander Winder, question for Dave: Hammond transformers versus classic tone and a Marshall Plexi circuit.
Output transformer. I use Habor transformers from Habor. I think they make about the best classic tone. I use for some things. Or technically, that's Magnetic Components that make them in Chicago, and I use the BE amp, the chokes I use from them, and the power transformers are custom made for us from them. Output transformers, though, I still use Habor because I like the tone of them.
Did you ever use electrical windings back in the day?
No.
That was the original. That is the one thing that did change on the Van Halen stuff with us is that electrical windings was making our output transformers for years. And when I got there, we were already using them for a lot of stuff. And Basler is the transformer company we used for power transformers forever, all the PV stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys are great. And electrical windings were sold. Someone else bought it, and I can't put my name, I can't remember exactly who it was. But when that happened, the prices went way up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
as it, you know, not that it's a cheap process in the first place, making those old, those multi-layer transformers, but we ended up, Basler ended up hiring a guy named Steve Chute who knew how to do the output transformers, and we switched them over on probably in the late, somewhere around 98 or something like that. We did change the output transformer to a Basler, a Basler design, but not before we sent it to him to be approved and all that stuff, you know.
Right.
So, but that was, you know, we used those Baslers, and I used their stuff also when I was at Custom, you know, most, you know, partially because I was used to working with them, and they made a reasonable priced product, you know, and
with those big welded plates on the bottom of the transformer.
Yeah. Now that, that welded plate thing, that's a, that's a cost deal. You know, it's a lot cheaper and a lot stronger to do it that way, but it's not the best thing to do to a transformer as well to plate onto the stack.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Yeah, that's, not, I always wondered about that, but it's definitely strong.
It's not a, it's not a, an ideal situation. It generates heat because you're kind of shorting out part of the stack. So it, it was a, but they designed it, they sort of over-designed the transformer to accommodate that. And you ended up with something, you know, I'm sure you've replaced plenty of those Marshall transformers with that ear broken off of them because it's metal. You never replaced one of those on those PVs. You know, that chassis would be bent all to hell before that transformer would come apart. So it's, you know, we tried to build stuff that you could, you couldn't tear up, you know.
What always kind of amazed me is, like, if you really look at the, like, the build of the 5150 or something, and you really look at it, it's like, you know, a one-sided circuit board, and there's a lot of jumpers, and the preamp tubes where they go in, the, that board flexes like a mother, you know, and all this stuff. And if you look at that from a build perspective, you would think, well, this is just a piece of junk. But the funny thing is,
it's not.
They work forever.
Yeah.
They do, they're like a workhorse. They last forever.
It was,
and it's, and I'm not exactly sure why, but they do.
Well, it's because it's a, you know, we did things that, that we used parts that were good. We didn't use expensive, elaborate parts. We used parts that you could put in by machinery as opposed to, you know, some of the more expensive parts that you might have to put in by hand. The trans, that tube socket thing was an idea that we had that helps feedback by having the tubes horizontal to the motion. They're less likely to feedback than they are when they're hanging down or sticking up.
Right.
Just a, you know, just a thing we were doing. It was a technique we were using. And, you know, there was, there's, of course, there's all kinds of limitations to that stuff, but it was like, it was really the perfect thing for what he was looking for, because he said he wanted to be able to go in a music store in London and buy an amp because his amp screwed up and get the same thing. And not have to go get some tweaked out fancy thing that somebody had gone up. And frankly, he used to do that. You know, I didn't mention this earlier, but after that first tour, not after it, halfway through it, we started building the production amps. You know, I said we built 8 and sent them to him of prototypes, me hand tweaking them, make sure they were right and all that. Tweak, not to mean that tweaking like they were different, but to check them all, you know. Well, we sent him 8. We sent him 4 production amps halfway through that tour. And they sent us back 4 of the prototypes. And then he ended up using one of those production amps for the rest of that tour. And his big thing was that being able to go to a music store and buy the thing that's actually what he uses, not, not something that you'd have to go get it, you know, tweaked in order for it to be right. You know what I'm saying? In fact, he even told me that one time that he had somebody build a hand wired version of it, of the 5150. He just wanted to see if it would sound better. And he said it sucked. It just wasn't anything like the other one, you know, because you know how that is. You, you do something on a circuit board, everything's where it is, you know. You do it hand-wired when it might, this might be crossing that other thing and injecting into all kinds of ways. There's lots of interactions you can deal with when you start, you know, hand wiring things. You have to be real careful about where the wires are laid and how close they are, proximity and stuff. Mm-hmm. For capacitive coupling and stuff.
Didn't Steve Stevens, he got 5150s also, I think, as a gift from Ed, and then he used them for a while as well, right?
I didn't know that, but I know that he did a lot of that kind of stuff. He would, you know, order some from us or something for various guys. Same thing with Jerry Cantrell on that. The first tour, I want to say they were with Baby Animals, the first tour. And then they were with Alice in Chains, the second one or something. Maybe I got them backwards. But anyway, when they were with Alice in Chains, he got us to send out some amps for Jerry Cantrell. Same kind of deal, you know. Because, of course, he was proud of it. You know, he was into this whole thing. Here's this amp I've done with Peavy, and check it out, you know. But, you know, Ted Nugent toured with him in the end of the 90s for several tours. He was opening for Kiss on one of their various farewell tours, used them. So
yeah, well, a lot of guys used a 5150.
Well, I'll tell you somebody you wouldn't guess. Steve Cropper used a 5150. Everybody would be like, "Oh, you're crazy! Don't even say that." He did. Steve Cropper loved the clean sound of the 5152, So I took a 5152. And the cabinets, we made him some 215 ones. Same baffle, but we put 215s in it because that was the 15-inch speaker that he liked. And he toured for a good while with that 5152. Of course, he didn't use the lead channel, of course. You're not Steve Cropper. But he loved that clean because it was so tight, and he was into that.
Right. I'll tell you one thing also. The 5150 is one of probably the most modeled amps also. I mean, if you go on to any of these Axe FX, Kemper, you know, they all have a 5150 model, you know, just like they have a Friedman model.
it was a cool thing to have been a part of. I'll have to admit, you know, I mean, I like I said, I grew up with Van Halen, and then I got to meet him and work with him and stuff. You know, there was ups and downs, you know, there was hard times through that period, like we talked about a minute, but overall it was a really cool experience, you know?
Yeah. And Joe Satriani and all those guys. I mean, that's just super cool.
I mean, I even worked on an amp with Schecter a few years ago for the Hellwind for Sinister Gates. Yeah. The Avenged Sevenfold guitarist. And
that's cool.
That was kind of loosely based off of a custom amp that I did called the Double Cross. And hey,
we got a question here, James, for you. This is from the String Skipper. Have James talk about the new compressor pedal he's designed.
All right, that's the pressurizer. It's a. Let's see, I got one right here. I had that guy email y'all with that so that I could bring this up. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. This is the pressurizer. And this is our junior size pedal that we do. All of our pedals have that roll bar on the back to protect the knobs and stuff. And try to come up with my own shape, you know. So
that's a cool design, that angled back deal, because it keeps the knobs away from your foot. And, you know, you're not going to stomp on the knobs or even chance of hitting it even. And then the roll bar protects it more. I always thought that was cool.
And it's got – those small ones have like a – you can unscrew this and the bottom falls off. It's got holes in it so you can mount it to the pedal board if you got a wood board or something.
Cool.
Or you can use tie wraps on it and then mount this back down onto it like that. But the pressurizer, it's a compressor pedal, but unlike – you know, there are a lot of them with blend controls, like this one has a blend control.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was tweaking it, you know, I hate compressors, I'll be honest with you. I didn't really want to do one, but so many people were saying, "Hey, man, can you make a compressor that sustains but doesn't screw with my attack?" Mm-hmm. And I was like, they all do that, don't they? I mean, that's kind of the first thing it does is if you hit it hard, it takes that away, you know?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And so I started thinking about it. Well, what if I could make the compressor come in a little bit after the attack? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like a pre-delay.
Kind of like a pre-delay. That's one way to think about it. Instead, what I did is the compression, if you turn it all the way to wet and you crank the compression up and you hit it, the note goes away and it sounds kind of like one of those backward effects where you play the notes and they come swelling in, you know?
Oh,
it's a little cool. It's a little bit like
cool
that.
For something.
Well, it's kind of useless by itself.
Yeah.
But what you do is you take it and you mix the dry in with it.
Yeah.
So what happens is when you first hit the note, the compressed side's gone. It goes away. And the dry sound just sounds normal. So you get your regular old attack like you like. But then after a second or two, that compressed signal blends back in. And right when your guitar starts dying off, that other one comes in and it takes over. And so it doesn't screw with your attack. It leaves the attack alone. So you can play this in front of a distortion and you won't hear any different if you set it up like that. It'll just sound like
Very
it
cool.
always does. But when you hold a note down, as your note starts dying off, the compressor kicks in and brings it back in and keeps it going. So it's it's like a crossfade sort of a thing.
Very cool. That's unique.
And you know, it was like that came from listening to people and thinking about what they were asking for. You know, a lot of guys do that blend, and that's a pretty good approximation of what I'm trying to do. But what I did is I made the compressor so it would over compress, kind of. It's like it over compresses the note completely away at first. And then that way, when you blend that to the dry, all you hear is the dry at first until that note dies off, and then the compressed part comes in.
Very cool.
And then it's got kind of a neat trick here on the side. It's a boost knob. You know how a lot of guys that use compressors, they'll just leave them on all the time?
Mm-hmm.
This one, if you press and hold the switch, it locks the compressor on and turns the LED green. And then when you hit the switch again, it kicks in this boost on the side. So basically, instead of not having a switch that you can do anything with, you just lock it on, and now you can hit this off and on and have that boost. So, like, if you got a guitar that's weaker, you can kick it up.
It's very, very, very cool.
You know, or if you like the compression all the time and every now and then you want to beat up your amp a little more, you just kick on that boost.
Very cool.
And that's kind of a thing we're doing that on several different products. I actually got a new product I'll show you. This is not the actual product. This is the artwork of it. It's called Curveball. Mm-hmm. You see that?
Yep.
And what it is, it's going to be based off of that same two-switch thing. It's a three-band EQ with a boost. So it's a three-band EQ boost, and it's got that side switch. So if you want to just have that EQ after everything and just tweak it like you like, you can press that and lock it. And then when you hit it, it's another boost. You can use it for an EQ to set up your levels like your tone like you want, and then still hit that switch afterwards and use it to give you like a solo boost.
That'd be great in the loop.
Right. You use it in the loop would be a real obvious, cool way to use it. Or if you're just using pedals, just put it at the end. Or even if you wanted to do like dial in a certain EQ for your preamp boost, you know, like if you're trying to, I've got it set up to where if you crank the mid up way up high, it looks like a parked wah. So you can also use it in front of the amp and get that kind of parked wah beating up the amp sound.
Right. Cool.
So that's our new thing we're going to be showing at the NAMM show. So please don't tell anybody about it yet.
All right.
I'll cut it out. Yeah, make sure and don't tell anybody about that. Yeah,
right. So you'll be at NAMM, right?
Yep.
Which will be cool.
We got a booth 4034. They moved everybody around at NAMM this time.
Everyone, all the guitar stuff is in one spot.
One loud room,
which is good. Well, that room used to be louder. It used to be the drum room. So.
Oh, that was the drum room. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was downstairs, right?
No, it's above the Hall E is downstairs, and this area that everybody's going to be is above that.
Yeah.
So right where the escalators come up is Hall D, I think is what they call it.
Correct. Okay. Yep.
And that's where all of the guitar guys will be, guitars and amps and stuff.
Cool. And pedals and everybody. That's awesome. Right. Very cool. Hey, you know what? This is a good time to do the second question, trivia. What do you think?
Yes. Go for it.
Let's do it. All right. I'm going to scroll down to the bottom. All right.
I'm going to sneak out for a second.
Okay. No problem. Ice Coffee Tone says you guys should live stream NAMM. We'll probably do something. I know it was really hard last time when we went to Summer NAMM. Dave was working and I was.
Yeah. The only problem with live streaming at NAMM is
Wi-Fi.
A lot of times the Wi-Fi is not good, and also the cell service generally sucks, depending on the cell service you have. So it kind of does present some problems, but we'll try to do some Facebook Live stuff from the booth and from the room. Of course, I will be tied up heavily as usual, but you know, just our booth alone, we'll have lots of stuff going on. So
yeah, I'll go live at some point, and as long as I have some connection, and then of course the nightlife stuff, we'll do something, you know, when we're going out at night. So, all right, you guys ready? People are ready. Tell me you're ready in the chat, because I'm going to ask this next question for the Buxom Boost pedal. Dave, you got one ready to send to somebody, right?
I got hundreds ready to send. Well, I'm not going to send hundreds, but
I'm going to say just one for free. Just one for free.
Okay, we have readies in the chat. I see.
All right. Everybody's ready. All right. All right. So, episode 14, when John Sir was working on an amp when he was working at Bob Bradshaw's, what happened to him and his necklace? When John Sir was working on an amp when working at Bob Bradshaw's, what happened to him and his necklace? All right, guys. First one to answer this correctly gets the pedal. Okay, someone got half of it. You got to get. Oh, it's coming quick.
There we go. DJ Asterisk, I think.
Burnt the balls off?
Yep.
Yes, that is it.
Is that the first one that did that? Yes.
DJ Asterisk is the one who got it. He blew his balls off.
Damn.
Or burned his balls off.
That was the story.
We had something weird.
I'm not sure
I want to hear the rest of that story.
Oh, yeah, it's an interesting story. There's a little a necklace that John Sir was wearing once when he was working on an amp, and this little – wasn't it some sort of – Mark, what was the necklace of again? Wasn't it some sort of –
He said it was a man walking with a cane. It was a man walking with a cane that was supposed to be for like good luck or something, he said.
Oh.
I don't know about
– Don't tell me he let it get down in the amp or something.
Yeah, he did. Jeez. And threw him across the room, I think he said. And
the amp on his lap.
And on the necklace is like the balls got blown off.
That's funny. So Dave, how many times have you gotten shocked by an amp?
Oh my God. You know, here's the thing. Don't you think as the longer you do it, the more you wind up getting shocked in some respects because you're so careless?
Exactly. You're like, you start going, I won't worry about shorting that stuff out.
Yeah, you know, I can change that part while the amp's on, right?
Oh, I've done plenty of that, soldering something on while it's still hot.
Sure.
I've done that a million times. Yep.
That's hysterical.
I've done the whole thing where
you apart. Yeah.
grab this side and reach over and touch something on that side, and it goes right through you like that.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
How the hell did we live through all that stuff?
Well, you know, the funny thing, we have a there's a company in Germany called Amp-Pete, who makes these amp switchers, and they make some products and amps and stuff. And Peter, the owner, has come to work for the parent company, our partner, sort of. He's come to the U.S. now to work as the like a head engineer. Oh. And he goes, this is nothing. You try working in with, 50 hertz at 240 volts.
Exactly.
He goes, and more of the hertz than the voltage even. So you just try. He goes, you get shocked there and,
Exactly. I worked at a transformer manufacturer one time for about 6 months in Mississippi before I went to Peavey. And we made the kind that are this big, that are in those round things on the poles.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, they're like 15,000 volts and stuff. And they're soaked in oil to make the dielectric of the paper in there high enough so they won't explode. And every now and then they would run one and not have the oil level quite high enough, and that stuff would blow all to pieces. I'm talking about throwing stuff all over the plant out there.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
You don't want to mess around. But tube amps are very dangerous, and yet something you can't say it to people enough to be very careful. If you're ever messing with one, you can sure hurt yourself, especially when you start fooling around with something that's got 6550s in it, you know, because they're almost always SVT? Higher. Man, all those amps have a lot higher voltage, and it's noticeably bad. So
be careful.
I guarantee you I've thrown stuff against the wall and walked out before after it grabbed me a couple, shook me a little bit. You know, you get kind of scared to work by yourself. I used to do that a lot at Peavey. I'd work it later in the evenings and stuff. And after a couple of times of something grabbing you like that, I was like, screw this. I'm going home.
Yeah, exactly. Someone will find you on the floor the next day. That happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, DJ Asterisk, you won. You're the first one that said to burn the balls off. So send me an email. At tonetalkmark@gmail.com. Okay. And I will get, I'll send it over to Dave and Dave will get the pedal out to you. Okay.
Yep.
All right. And let's see. I want to get to some questions.
Cool. I didn't know y'all did did y'all do that trivia stuff every time?
No. We just did a giveaway this time. Hey, I'll be right back.
Holiday giveaway.
I see.
Yeah, well, just, you know. What's that?
That's cool.
Yeah, you know. Figured why not give a little holiday cheer, spread some warmth around the world.
Exactly.
let's see. We have RMG471 says, I'm a new tube amp owner or user, converted from a Kemper. Can you have James and Dave recommend normal tube amp maintenance?
Normal. That's the word. Normal is kind of doesn't work for tube amps a lot of times, because, you know, a lot of guys, it depends on how much you play through them. You know, when you're dealing with solid state stuff, you can play a solid state and there's no life to the, how am I supposed to say this? It's like, on tubes, the plate material itself wears off over time, so they actually have a life to them. Solid state devices don't have that; they just continue to work. They'll work. You might never have to replace anything in them, except maybe some capacitors over time that might dry out or something. The bigger capacitors, but in a tube amp, if you play a tube amp a lot. Like, let's say you play gigs every week and you crank it and you're like, you're playing pretty loud. Then I'd say probably at least once a year, you're going to have to swap the power tubes out because you're going to start losing the volume. It'll just get lower and lower over time. And the same with the preamp tubes. Eventually, they'll start losing gain. Mm-hmm. And it's because the tube itself, the way it works, the material moves from one spot to the next, and over time, it'll just wear out. They just go bad. They wear themselves out. Unlike solid state, like that camper thing, you never have to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, Dave, they were talking about, guy was asking about, he just switched over from a camper rig to some tube amps and was wondering about what kind of normal tube maintenance should he expect. And I was just kind of going through, how it depends on how much you play it, but you might elaborate on that if you want. It
totally depends on how much you play it. But lately, these days, if the amp still sounds good to you and it's still working, leave the tubes alone.
I'm with you on that 100%.
Because man, let me tell you, the pains I've had with EL34s recently is just...
Even new ones. God.
New ones in production.
Yeah, you know? People think that just because you put new tubes in, it's got to be better. But that's not necessarily the case.
And just because you put new tubes in, that they must work.
Exactly. They're not guaranteed.
Sometimes they're not worked out of the box. They don't work.
Exactly.
Or they go bad. Or microphonic preamp tubes. Just because they're new preamp tubes doesn't guarantee they're not microphonic.
I know nobody sells pre-tested, guaranteed quality tubes. Nobody does.
No, and the problem we've had we had a problem with JJ power tubes. Our EL34 is essentially it's a problem that happened about 5 years ago. They all started kind of crackling and just right out of the box. And they could be fine for a while, and then all of a sudden start crackling too. So that's another problem.
Was it like from it moving, like physically moving?
No,
and it was crackling.
No, they just do it on their own.
Yeah, that's hard to deal with.
And then red plate or then fail.
Yeah.
So that got really bad and we couldn't, you know, and we test amps and we think they'd be fine.
Yeah.
You know, and they're burned in for like overnight and tested. And I personally test the play test, everything that leaves the door, and they're working fine. And then after a while I was banging on the tubes, like really considerably hard to try to make them fail. And some of them check fine. Sure enough, just let it go in the field for a minute and it fails.
Yeah.
And then I switched to a Chinese EL34, like the STR kind of one. And that's pretty good, but they're a little fragile also. They're a little prone to shorting.
Well, EL34s aren't great to start with.
Yeah.
None of them are really.
And so that had issues too. And it's funny, it's an issue even Bruce Eggnetter told me the other, like a little while ago, he goes, yeah, early on we were using Ruby EL34s and he would tap on the tube on the bench, you know, just hit it with a screwdriver, like, you know, not excessively, but tap on it like you do when you're testing tubes and, you know, it would short, it would fail. So he even had the guy from Magic Parts there, and he's like, well, don't hit him.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what do you mean don't hit them? They're going to go in an amplifier and get bounced around in the back of a truck.
Right. What do you think?
Don't hit them.
What do you think the UPS guy does? He drops the box off.
No, that doesn't work, you know? Yeah. So
That's not a real field test.
So recently – because there's not so many choices either.
Tom McNeil is that guy.
Yes. Yeah.
Tom McNeil.
Yeah. That supposedly that Bruce said he had said at the time. Just getting my facts straight. I didn't say he said that.
I've used Ruby tubes for years. In fact, they were the 6L6s that we used back in the early 90s when we couldn't find anything else that was close to that Sylvania tube. They were the only ones that had something that was good.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with Ruby tubes or magic parts or, you know.
But just like any manufacturing techniques, you know, you build stuff, sometimes you run into issues. And tubes, they kind of suck.
So now I've switched to the EL34s.
Yeah.
And they've been, so far, been rock solid. No issues. Almost no failures whatsoever in production.
Yeah, that's I used their power tubes and preamp tubes when I was at Custom. We were using EHs, the long plate 12X7s that they had at the time, but I also liked the STR Ruby tubes. 6L6s were nice. I didn't use the EL34s too much of theirs, but I used the EH. EL34s on some stuff.
And you had good luck with them?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So,
it's an ongoing thing, right? It's always been that way. And ever since probably the 80s when everybody in the U.S. stopped building tubes. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize, everybody thinks, well, why'd they quit making tubes in the U.S.? It's not just because they weren't a need for it or people buying them. It's because of the EPA, because the processes for making a tube create things that you don't want to be putting in the water system. And so it's kind of the platings and things on the metal to make it work and all that stuff. It got to where it was too hard for anybody to make any in the U.S. So they moved it all. It all went away. You know, and that's why they make tubes in China and some in Russia and what have you. I know back in the early 90s, there was some Czechoslovakian parts. What is Czechoslovakia called now?
Slovakia?
That area has changed. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's called,
Czech Republic.
Yeah.
At the time, they were making some tubes. And I never used Russian tubes at Peavey until later on when Mike Matthews started bringing in those EH ones, the Sovtek tubes in the late 90s.
Yeah, I mean, early on, those weren't that greatest. But now I think the latest incarnation of these EH EL34s, they sound good and they work. You know what? As long as they're working.
I know.
Honestly. I mean, honestly, guys, that's really what I'm really caring about. I mean, is there something slightly better sounding? Maybe. It's hard to say, but, you know.
Is it worth having failure every 6 months? I just want it to work.
And in production, you're making thousands of amps. So you're going through boatloads of tubes, and boy, if you see something wrong, something is wrong in a bad way for you, you know?
Yeah.
If something starts failing, it's like bad.
Yep.
Man. Did we lose Mark?
Good old tubes. I don't know.
I don't see Mark. I think we lost Mark. Well, guys, just us now.
Hey, man.
Mark will be back. Let's see. Maybe I can find a question. Guys, re-ask your question so I don't have to go back so far. How about that? If we missed it, re-ask them, and I'll catch it. The list gets so long that you can't even know where you left off. So I saw you also had another pedal, like a modulation pedal, right, in your line?
I did a pedal a couple of years ago called a swirl pool.
Yeah. That's what I noticed.
And that when I was at Custom, you know, the Custom, the early, one of the coolest things that Custom did back in the 70s, 60s was their Vibe. And, of course, John Fogerty used those amps. And they had, they had this tremolo and Vibe that was two circuits that were blended together and they were synchronized.
Yeah.
So
the Fender like trem Vibe thing that was in some amps, right?
Yeah, kind of like the harmonic Vibe that Fender did, but not exactly the same, because for one thing it was all solid state. But what it was, it's an amplitude modulation part, which is the tremolo, and the Vibe part is kind of like a phase shifter, frankly. It's a little bit like a phase shifter. And but the two things are locked together all the time, so they move together.
And yeah, that was in some era Fender amps, right? The ones, I can't remember which one it is.
Well, the Fender amp had the Vibe by itself. The one you're talking about, the brown ones.
Yeah, the one that has that kind of vibey tremolo thing. That was the
harmonic Vibe by itself. What Custom did back in the late 70s, and Magnetone had them as well. Who knows who came up with it first and who, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The reality was the one that Fogerty used had an amplitude modulation and a frequency modulation, and the two things worked together. So it was kind of like they were synchronized. It wasn't two things doing whatever. It was two things that were synchronized together.
Right.
And so what it gave you was a particular sounding tremolo that was real, I call it swampy, you know, the sound he got. So when I was at Custom, I did this amp, the one that over here behind me, the called the 72 Coupe. And I wanted to use some of that old technology, so I redid that circuit. And it uses OTAs, which is like the same parts that are in compressor chips. It's an operational transconductance amp. Kind of like a VCA, where the voltage controls the amplitude, the gain of the other thing. So anyway, I took that circuit and I did a pedal version of it when I started Amp Tweaker. A lot of people were asking me for it, including John Fogerty. And he wanted me to do something so that he could take it on tour and be able to use it. And I built this pedal. I also had all these customers who wanted it to have two speeds and be able to ramp between them and that sort of thing. So I built this fairly elaborate pedal. It's kind of a bigger pro size pedal. Hang on. This is just a tester version of it, but you can see what it looks like. Of course, it's surf green because it's got to be. And basically, it does those two sounds. And it's been fairly successful. We've sold a bunch of them. It's an 18-volt circuit, and he actually bought two or three of them. He doesn't endorse anything, so it's not like something that we could you know, market or anything. But
no, you just did, though.
Oh, I wasn't supposed to say that. You know, but I know somebody else built him something that was a little bit closer to what he was looking for a while back, and I think he still uses that stuff. But anyway, that's what that circuit is. It's an OTA kind of a circuit from back in the 60s, you know. One thing that I did that was kind of neat is I put some switches on there that allow you to slide them. So instead of the amplitude and the frequency being together, you can move them apart so that it could be more like a Leslie, where the speaker, where the frequency change happens different from when the volume change happens. It's kind of complicated, but basically instead of being right together, you can make them opposite so it gets louder when the frequency's changing the most, that kind of thing. And you can get all kind of different swimmy sound and tremolo sounds out of it with that. So
cool. Very cool. Cool. Hey guys, my internet had crapped out there for a moment.
Yeah. So, you know, we lost you.
I know. But surprisingly the show still kept going. I don't know how that worked out,
not
but
sure why.
We backed you up, man. We were like, we didn't want to embarrass you or nothing. So we just pretended like you were going out to get us a drink or something.
Okay, cool. Or I went to the boys' room.
So going to the questions here, that I did ask people to repost some questions or something because it's so hard to get to them. So someone goes, after the tube discussion we were having, some folks were asking about changing he says capacitors, what I'm assuming is filter capacitors. How long should they last just in general?
Well, if you're talking about the inner coupling caps and stuff, if you're talking about caps. The big filter caps, we used to talk about 10 years back in the day, but I think maybe they, in the last 20 or 30 years, maybe they're a little better than they used to be. Those old paper ones were pretty crappy, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. It depends on how much you use the amp, too, kind of.
Exactly.
Sometimes it actually is better if you've used the amp a bunch than it just sat there, you know?
Yeah.
So believe me, if your amp is – like I saw a funny video on somewhere about some guy replacing the filter caps in his Bogner Shiva amp or something.
Right. It's like 2 years old or something.
I'm like going – Why? Who talked this guy into doing this, and why the hell are you doing it? Because they're not expired. They're fine. It's a pretty new modern amp. I highly doubt there's anything wrong with any of them. There's old Marshalls I've worked on that the caps still read right in value and are still good, and that's from 1960 something.
I'm with you on not changing tubes and just because you think you should. Mm-hmm. I'm with you on all that stuff.
Yeah.
And the cap thing, I think what it is there's a lot of mojo that gets spewed especially over the internet. Now everybody knows everything about tube amps and stuff. And so there's a lot of, and what'll happen is guys will be playing an amp they've had for a while. And maybe for whatever reason, they're just not happy with their tone. And so they look for ways to
improve it.
You might say excuses for why the amp that isn't cutting it anymore, but 9 times out of 10, those kinds of things, if it's not humming or if it's not, shutting down or something weird, the capacitors are probably fine. It's not that, maybe you need an overdrive pedal or maybe you need a different amp. Mm-hmm. It's my thing on that. I've never been one to change tubes very often. Funny thing about tubes, I was telling you about how back in when we first started the Van Halen tour stuff, we were starting to run out of those old Sylvanias. And mm-hmm. and when we started getting low on them, first thing we did is I found that Chinese tube that sounded pretty good. And we started selling those for over-the-counter people that wanted to buy one over-the-counter and saved all of our good Sylvanias for the 5150s. Well, mm-hmm. Eddie and it about every 2 weeks, the Artist Relations guys would get an email from Matt wanting more tubes. And I talked after about 6 months worth of every 2 weeks sending him out another two sets or whatever, I emailed him or called him rather. We didn't have email back then. I called him. And I was like, "Hey man, what's going on?" He said, "Well, nothing." He said, "Everything's great." And I said, "Well, what's with all these tube failures?" He said, "We don't have any failures. We just change them out every gig." They were taking every gig. They were taking all the tubes out of those amps and swapping them. The power tubes, not the preamp mm-hmm. tubes, but the power tubes. They would take all four of them out and throw them away.
That's crazy.
And put brand new ones. And these were those Sylvanias that were worth $1 million now if you could find one.
It's like even if you wanted to say to them, "Can you send those old tubes back?"
Exactly. please send me those and I'll throw them away.
I'll recycle them.
Exactly.
That's funny.
You know, we used a few, a little bit less, one 6 month period when they accidentally had a tube fail and Eddie, and it sounded better with the one tube not working. It was three.
Good story.
Two on one side, one on the other. You know, a lot of guys used to ask me if Eddie was using a tweaked amp all that time, you know, like a modified amp. And the only time that I'm aware of that he used something that wasn't factory was that time when, for about 6 months or something, they used two on one side and one on the other of the power tubes because it sounded cool, you know. And what happens is you get a little bit of more asymmetrical clipping when you do that. You know, one side swinging normal and the other side's getting limited a little bit. So it's, frankly, it sounds a little bit more like preamp distortion when you do that kind of thing. But they did that for a while. They toured with three tubes in the power amp after that scenario.
Interesting. Hey, I got a question.
So I got something.
Okay. No. You want me to go or you got it?
You got it. Go.
V-Man, sorry to keep asking, but I'm curious. Did James work on the original PV Butcher amp from the 80s?
Nope.
We covered that.
I came in right after the Butcher was already there before I started. And the VTM was my first amp, which was take the Butcher and make it into this modified, more high gain kind of thing.
I gotcha.
So the answer is no, I didn't work on that. I started in 80s. Six.
Okay. That's when I graduated high school.
Hey, man, don't be starting running on me about how old I am.
I graduated in 87, so there you go.
Both of y'all are kicking me. Yeah, that's hard, man. I wouldn't do you that way. Hey.
Sorry,
When you guys are older than me, I'm not going to beat you up about it.
Oh, that's true. You won't.
Mark Showalter, I think that's his name. Sorry if I butchered that.
That's one of my customers.
I know. He says, he wants to know what pedal would you like to make that you haven't come out with yet? And he said, don't forget to mention my stereo swirl pool.
Yep, Mark has a stereo swirl pool. I made a modified one for him. We do a lot of mods and stuff for guys that ask for special things. I'd say probably the things that I haven't done, the one thing I need to do is I want to do like a nice drive, you know, something that does more of the there's a million guys out there chasing that Klon pedal and various barely overdriven sounds. That's a real popular thing. And we've been real successful with heavier gain, but for the moderate gain and or the very barely distorted kind of sounds, I don't really have as big a following for that stuff. And the first step towards that, I just on that pressurizer I showed earlier, I have an output FET circuit that's kind of like the FET input of a dumble, where it just uses a FET and it's not a whole lot of gain and you end up with kind of a nice distortion, and it's not really distorted. It's just barely breaking up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of working on some ideas of incorporating that into a line of cleaner, if you will, drive pedals, you know, that aren't so heavy, aren't so high gain. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the next important thing. I'm working on about five things all at once, and unfortunately that makes it hard to finish things when you work on too many things at one time, you know. So
right. Mm-hmm. Here's a question we got from someone that I don't even know how to do it, but the name, forget. hey, Dave, you heard about tube manufacturing is going to end sooner or later. That's why Vox is making their substitutes. Do you worry about that, and what will you do? I, you know, I don't see it ending really soon. There's a lot of tubes out there right now from a lot of factories, and for it to end, even if it all ended, there's still a lot of production tubes that are out there still. So, you know, maybe I won't be alive when that happens. So, you know, it might not matter really.
Well, look, I mean, back in the 80s, Hartley thought $500,000 worth of power tubes would be enough to last till the end of time.
You know what I'm saying?
And here we are 30 years later, and we're still building tube amps, talking about it on the internet, whatever the internet is. We didn't even know what that was back then.
And if we feel that's going to happen, you believe you me, we'll buy a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That's true.
It's not happening yet. So,
this is a good question that came from Imagery Arts. Can you explain fixed bias versus adjustable? And the reason why I say this is a good question, because the 5150 is a fixed bias, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a
let's clarify something a little bit. There's a couple different things. There's cathode bias. There's a fixed bias and an adjustable bias, right? So, cathode bias is a lot of amps like Voxes and everything else. Voxes are a couple of my amps are cathode biased. There's some old Fenders, Tweed Deluxe and things that are cathode biased.
Which means that it adjusts its own bias based on the tube and how much it draws through the tube, sets the bias on its own. So it's kind of like an automatic thing.
Correct. And, the fixed bias, well, you can go explain why that. That was always sort of...
A lot of people have adjustable bias on amps, and that's really for the most power and the most accuracy of the output waveform, that's the best thing to do, really. Because you get a lot of power, you don't throw away much, and at the factory or when a tech gets it, they'll adjust it till it's not too much crossover distortion and you get a good sound. Now, what we did at Peavey is we used a fixed bias, and all it was is we just set the bias to an amount that worked pretty good for everything. It was, and typically we ran it a little bit cooler than most guys would do it. And because of that, a lot of those Peavey amps, you know, we were always known for stuff lasting a long time. See?
Yeah, well, now it was like... 15 to 20 milliamps per tube, something like that, if I recall. The
5150, for example, was running fairly cool.
Yeah.
You know, we used to run it at about -55 volts with, a little over 500 volt rails, and it ran pretty cool at that point. But we weren't really going for power amp distortion in that amp in the first place. We were going for that preamp distortion that it got. So the bias was less of a factor on the sound of it, the basic sound. Mm. Now it did, you know. Granted, if you run them hotter, it does have a warmer sound even at low volumes. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, running them cooler like that, we didn't mind the little bit of extra distortion you got from it, because we were so damn distorted by that time you couldn't hear it anyway. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So. But now when I was at Custom, I did something that was a little bit unusual. I think maybe Fender and or Vox both tried this back in the 70s, but I did what you call a partially self-biased. And what I did is I had a cathode resistor that self-biased the amp, but I also had a fixed bias going to it as well. So half the bias came from a power supply, and the other half came from it automatically setting itself. And by doing that, it got a little bit hotter than a typical Class AB like we all do with the adjustable bias. It was a little hotter than that, but not as hot as running it full self-bias like you mentioned before, like a Vox type of approach. And by doing that, we sort of had a little, you might say, the best of both worlds, because it got a little bit more power than if it was self-biased. But it would still control itself some. If as the tube changed over time, it would adjust on its own a little bit. And I did that on the custom amps and also on that Schecter amp that I did for Helwin, the Helwin for Sinister Gates. You know.
Yeah, because I know that there's some guys who talk about modding the 5150s and putting in an adjustable bias on it.
Yeah, and you know, you do get it. You can do that. You can get a different sound.
It sounds better, yeah.
I think it sounds a little richer. You can certainly get a little bit fatter, I would say, tone that way. When I was doing that little mini stack, I ran the bias. It turned out, you know, based on the circuitry, it turned out that it was running a little hotter, and I was surprised by I got measurably more low end out of the amp just from that bias being a little hotter.
Mm-hmm.
But keep in mind, when you start doing that, you start burning through those tubes quicker too.
Right.
You know, and we used to rarely have failures in the field or anything from those amps when we would run the bias cool like that. You know,
yeah, that's why it lasted forever.
It lasts forever. It's just one of those things. It's all these things are trade-offs, right? It's like, yes, it might sound better, but for how long, you know?
Yeah.
So, and as long as you're willing to, you know, swap tubes out more often and hire guys to tweak your amp for you when it gets worn out, that's fine. So. I think maybe the self-biased is one of the better approaches of all because it sounds great and they because it automatically adjusts over time, it stays that way. It doesn't, you know, it kind of like compensates its own bias as you go along, you know. But they still don't last as long as like a Class AB design, like just like a lot of people use with the adjustable bias.
That's cool. So there was a question here from the Guitar Guru Network. Let's hear about the Helwin.
The Helwin. That was, I had already left custom and I was working, doing the amp tweaker thing. And they were approached by Schecter to do that amp with, Sinister Gates. And so they asked me if I would participate in that. And basically I took a double cross and, Brian is his name, Sinister. We all call him Sinister Gates. His name's Brian is his actual name. And he was using like one of the four channel Marshalls or something at the time. And it had a moderately high gain. Probably not nearly like a 5150, but it had certainly more than like a one of those 90s modded Marshall kind of thing. So it was, you know, a fairly heavy sound. And I was able to take that double cross and tweak it and basically convert it into what we ended up doing for that amp. The double cross had six L6s in it. And I had a, and I took the same transformer set and used it for 4 6L6s, which is also kind of the same trick I used on the Van Halen amp. I didn't bring that up a while ago, but most of the time when you're doing an amp for four tubes, you design it to have a transformer that can handle four tubes. Well, the 5150 had a transformer, a power transformer that could handle six tubes. And the reason was it was a transformer we already had that we used for the old Roadmaster, which was a 6-tube power amp. Mm. And it had a bias winding on it separate from everything else. And that was part of the deal is I wanted to have a bias so we could really dial that in. So I used that and it was a little bit over designed. Well, the benefit of that is the tubes, the power transformer doesn't sag at all. You know, we use solid state rectifiers. Between that and the over-designed power transformer, there's no sag. It's just like there, you know, the supplies are there. Mm-hmm. So when I did the Sinister Gates amp, the Helwin, I'd use the same kind of approach. I used that 6-tube double-cross transformer, and I used it with just four EL34s because he preferred those. And then basically I designed it and went back and forth with him a few tries. He was pretty easy to work with and to get what he was wanting. We spent quite a lot of time working on the noise gate, which for modern players, a lot of guys use noise gates now that didn't maybe back 20, 30 years ago. It's become more and more part of their sound. You know, almost all the metal guys use a noise gate and crank it way up so that the notes, the minute you stop playing, the note just goes chomp and shuts completely off. So that's like a critical element of their tone, you know.
It's kind of funny, you know, the noise gate thing is it was extremely prevalent noise reduction in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And for me making rigs, that was really integral always, that was always in there. And then it went away completely.
Yep.
And the only place it still exists generally is in the metal thing, using it to the extreme.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist for any of my other clients.
Yeah.
Jerry Cantrell's or you know, doesn't really, they don't use noise reduction on
stuff. Yeah, because they're not really into that hard stop and note thing.
Yeah, and then people go, well, what do they do about the hiss? I go, they just live with it.
Yeah.
Right, it's part of the sound.
Yeah. You know?
Because it's more important to them that the note dies off naturally, whereas the metal guys, it's all with a lot of the, especially the death metal crowd, it's really important that when everybody stops, it just goes quiet. It's like chomp, you know, kind of like Metallica when they go chomp, 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 they did that first chomp. It stops. There's nothing going on. There's no sound after that. And that absence of music is the sound that they were getting.
Mm-hmm. But I also think that the advent of more gain required it to be chopped off.
Yeah.
You know, like if you look at like the early Metallica like stuff, it wasn't anywhere near the amount of gain that exists now.
They were just palm muting.
Palm muting it, but it's not feeding back or taking off because there's less gain. And then it's also more percussive and punchier.
Because it's less gain.
More in your face because it's less gain.
Right. I agree. Nowadays, you for the last maybe 15 years, there's been a lot of these sounds where, especially when guys would use like dual rectifiers and stuff, the dual rectifier has a lot of a kind of, it's kind of like it's going between notes. So you play notes, and whether you stop or not, the sound just keeps right on going. So these guys would use these noise gates, or they would do it in the studio. They'd use Pro Tools. And every time that the band would stop, every time the chords would stop, the Pro Tools, they'd just chop it off so that it would have that you know, kind of a thing where there was these big openings between the notes. And that's that certain sound that a lot of the hardcore stuff has. And then the death metal guys figured out that, you know, if you just use a noise gate all the time, you can stand there and your guitar won't feed back or anything. That's another thing, is that the noise gate solves the problem of poorly potted pickups. If you have a pickup that wants to squeal, you can put a noise gate on there and pretty much nail it. You not have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. Whereas what we used to do is have to take that crap apart and soak it in melted wax and try to get it to stop squealing. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep. Dave, do you have any questions that you've identified, or you want me to?
No, I see someone asked me a question about pedal power supplies, which is really directed totally at me. Between switching and linear, well, what he's saying is switching and linear power supplies. Well, a properly done switching power supply is going to be very much more quiet than a transformer-based design, meaning a transformer-based design has a field hum around the power supply. So if you get cables or pedals too close to it, it can cause inject hum into your pedals, sort of like a single coil pickup if you get it near your amp, it hums. Or any pickup for that matter, if you get it too close to your amp, it hums. That's because the field hum from the power transformer. So, my power supply is a switching power supply. It's extremely quiet. I just finished Pete Thornton's pedal board with it, and boy, is that damn thing quiet. Again, a properly designed switching power supply. So most of the ones, you know, Strymon's, R's, the True Tone CS7 and CS12 are all those are really good supplies. G Lab is a good switching power supply also. The Dunlop brick is a switching, the little ISO brick is a switching power supply, the ISO one. And all are excellent power supplies. Just depends on what company you want to go with, really. Most of them provide, you know, current enough for anything. So that's my thought. And also, I tend to think a lot of the switching power supplies might even sound a little more like, this is getting really geeky, sound a little bit more like a battery. And don't ask, and I can't answer that question why. So, So there you have it.
All right. Hey, James, how you doing on time? Oh, he's got to put his ears in. So here's a question for you, Dave. This is from Teddy. Have you ever seen a degooped Dumble and know what makes a Dumble different from a Bassman?
I have. A Dumble is quite different than a Bassman. It's totally different. It's got two channels. It's got an overdrive channel. It's got a clean channel. It's got a lot of little tweaks. It's got a different power section. It's quite different.
Okay. James, how are you doing on time?
I'm fine. You know, I'm here for whenever you guys get ready.
Hey, okay. Someone made a comment too. Someone said RF hash with switching power supplies. Not with the, remember I quoted, I said a properly designed one. Most of the little transformers made today, the little wall wart transformers that are switching power supplies, are generally junk. A lot of them are.
Even some name brand ones.
Oh, sure. I know what you're talking about.
Not that I would name one, but.
Good ones in existence, Boss One works fine.
I like the Dunlop ECBs 4 and 3. Those are really
quiet.
Very quiet.
Yeah, because the problem, and the Boss one's really quiet. There's a couple others that aren't. And there's a lot of ones that manufacturers ship with their products.
Yeah.
Ship with their products that actually cause hum.
Which is stupid because then they can think that the pedal or whatever is crap.
I even have one that ships with one of mine that I actually have to change because we found out later and it wasn't like the sample that it was.
Yeah,
I got a sample and then later it was not, so that has to be changed. But so a lot of those are complete junk, including ones made for, shall we say, TC pedals and stuff that cause noise.
Yeah. Well, the problem is if you feel the need to provide a power supply with every pedal that goes out, think about that means that a person buying that pedal is having to pay for that power supply, whether they want it or not. So a lot of companies use the philosophy that rather than jack the price way up and put a nice one in there, we'll just put this crappy one in there. It's kind of like when you buy something with a crappy cord that comes with it. And, you know, the cord's microphonic or whatever. It's like, to me, just leave that stuff out. I don't ship power supplies with my stuff because so many guys have brick power supplies. And it's stupid to me to make everybody else pay for a power supply that if they're not going to use it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't ship.
I kind of use that philosophy.
I don't ship it either, except with my tube pedals. And actually, I need to change that out. So,
well, and if it's a tube pedal, I'm sure it's something special about it that you kind of need to. So,
well, yeah, but I mean, it draws a decent amount of current, right. but a lot of power supplies, it draws like 300 milliamps of current or something. So it's not too bad. And there's a lot of power supplies that will power that, especially the new ones and the ones we make and stuff. But, yeah. So, sorry if anyone's trying to use that and that's the case, but I'm going to change it. It just, we have a lot of them sitting there still. It was an accident.
Yeah. Power is critical. And a lot of people don't realize that, you know, you'll have people that are complain. They'll be in some country that the power supply is not quite right on their amp. It'll be a little bit low or something. And they can't understand why it doesn't sound right, you know,
or too high.
And, you know, on a solid state amp, it's pretty common to have regulation in the power supplies. But for tube amps, it'd be pretty expensive to put regulation on the power supply of those high voltage rails and stuff. So we don't ever do it. You know, we just hook it up and go with it. And you filter it a few times, and maybe you might have a choke in yours to make it filter good. But the bottom line is you can't set the rail, because the rail is going to be proportional to whatever the line voltage is. The worst thing is when you get into a city, almost always the power in a city will be higher at night than it is during the day, because they're trying to maintain a certain voltage during the day with all those businesses going. And then when everybody turns power off, everybody flips the light switches off at 5 o'clock, power goes up. So guys playing in gigs in the evenings, they'll blow up all their amps and stuff because the rails are higher than they normally would be. So, you know, you fight with stuff like that all the time. And it's just the way it works.
Yeah, that's interesting.
We don't have what you'd call a constant grid here, or especially in Europe and places like that, you know.
No, and it's funny. But then you also get the other problem that voltage is high. There's just like really high, like sometimes excessively high. Like I run into people, it's like, yeah, my wall voltage is reading, 129.
Yeah.
Like 129, geez. Supposed to be more around 117 to 120.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's high.
Well, you know, we always, with UL specs, you have to test everything for 10% high.
Yeah.
We would always design all of our stuff for 120, and then we'd make sure it would be okay at 132, you know, just to.
Yeah. Well, it'll be okay.
It safe. And
it's just sometimes it's hard on tubes, and sometimes it's hard on, you know, it's sometimes it doesn't sound that good because it kind of raises the voltage and the things get kind of brittle and weird sounding. So, so the guy that came up with that brown box thing is pretty good idea. If you're familiar with that, is what it is, guys, or look it up if not.
It's basically a kind of a high tech variac, right?
Basically. Kind of, yeah, but you're able to monitor your voltage that's coming in and able to, you know, knock it down. And
right.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I've seen Sammy touting it. I've seen this question a few times in the chat from Corey Clark. James, what are your thoughts on the newer EVH 5150s and the PV Invective?
You know what? I think I've played one of the EVH3s a couple of years ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago at the NAMM show. And it's all I've done is I just played through it. And I thought it feels a lot like the 5152 to me. I thought it sounded great. I mean, I thought it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the quality and all that stuff, I really don't have anything. I wouldn't know one way or the other because I just haven't messed with them much or talked to people about them that much or any of that. But I can tell you one thing. If Eddie Van Halen has anything to do with it, they're bound to be building them right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I told you earlier, he would get amps from us to give people and stuff like that. And he would, and he was using those production amps, but he also would go to the store every now and then and buy one and not tell us. He'd just go to the Guitar Center or wherever and buy one and just take it home and check it out. So, you know, kind of like checking to make sure that we were doing them right. And I, you know, I know damn well he's still doing that kind of thing where he's keeping an eye on the quality level because he's just that way. He's just that, that has that mindset, you know. And, you know, people used to ask me if he was real picky, and I say, yeah, he was very picky. And I said, but that's why we were glad to work with him. You know, if he wasn't that picky, it wouldn't have been a big deal. The fact that he, the fact that he was that discerning was the whole point. You know, why you even want to fool with it.
So now I agree with that. I played with the PV Invective at last winter NAMM. I found it to be more for higher gain kind of metal. Detuned metal.
It's got the overdrive in front of the 5150 sound, I believe, as I've read. I haven't played one myself, but apparently it's, you know, a lot of guys that use 5150s, they put a tube screamer in front of them or something like that. And the reason, of course, is because it makes it go chunk, like I was talking about earlier, is they're trying to tighten up that attack and what have you. It's not because it doesn't have enough gain. It's got plenty of gain. It's just that it's, they want it to stop. They want the notes to stop when they stop them. And I think that's what that Invective has, is it has some overdrive circuitry like that in front of it. And then the second part is maybe the, I'll never claim that the 5150 original one had a great clean sound, because it didn't. It was okay. You know, it was mostly a good crunch sound. A lot of people liked it for that. The 5152 had a nice clean sound, but I think the Invective, as I recall having read, that it may have more of a, the ability to get more of a Fendery kind of clean, you know, which is like more sparkly clean and not just that, what I'd call a Marshally clean. It's more chimey, you know. But it does. I know that there, that amp is made in the U.S., which is a nice, nice that they're starting to come back to the U.S. with some stuff.
Yeah, the guy.
I know all the guys that worked on that, and they're all sharp as a tack. John Fields comes to mind. He was my right hand guy back in the day before I left, and he took over that department afterwards and worked with those guys and.
Awesome. Well, good. Yeah. Cause I was out there, at the last winter NAMM and checked it out and it was good. It was cool. Any other questions, Dave, that you see that we haven't covered?
Yeah. Someone, George Russell, asked me about converting his amp from UK to US. If you're talking about one of my amps, the power transformer can be rewired, to do that. Just have to email me to find out how, or take it to a tech, and you still need the information though. And someone else made a comment about hum. I was talking about field hum problems with pedals and transformers, and then someone goes, "Well, yeah. What about then? There's the problem with transformers in pedals." Yeah, why does anyone do that? TC did it with their choruses. They all hum. Carl Martin continues to do it to this day with all their pedals, and they all hum.
You mean they have built-in power supplies?
Yeah, built-in. Yeah, it's like 120 volts in, and there's a little transformer in there, and guess what? It's like right next to the switch.
Yeah.
The foot switch, and I'm like going, how? No. And it hums. Of course it hums. It just, there's no way physically you can't get that transformer far enough away.
Yeah.
The thing is, sometimes I think these people listen to all this stuff into a totally clean amp when designing it. Because you listen to it into a totally clean amp.
That's a good point.
Totally good clean amp. And you know what?
Maybe might not notice it. Yeah.
You might not notice the hum.
That's true. You put it into a even a moderately high gain amp, and you'll and all of a sudden it's 30 dB louder.
Yeah, all the years that I've been doing pedal boards or testing things or anything, I always listen to it into a dirty amp because that amplifies every little noise there is possible. Sure. Yeah. And if it's quiet then, okay, then you can go to the you can go to the clean channel then and listen to it there, but you should listen to it both ways to make sure you're not missing some noise in your pedal or whatever you're doing, rig or whatever.
When I first started building pedals, my tight rocks and tight metals and stuff, I had a little bit of an issue at first where I didn't notice that when the pedal was off, if you put another pedal after it that was high gain, you could turn the knobs and stuff and you'd hear stuff. You'd hear it going because it was noise that was getting amplified in it. Even though I had it shutting it off, it was shutting down. But there was enough noise and stuff in there that you could hear it, but only if you had a high gain pedal after it.
Right.
So, you know, like a guy who uses just one pedal, he would never hear that. But a guy that uses five of them, he might have mine sitting there off, and then two down the road would be a high gain pedal, and all of a sudden I'm adding noise to his pedal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good thing.
Yes. So I figured that out, and I had to add a little extra circuit in there to shut that crap off so you wouldn't be, you know. But on a normal just testing one at a time, you never hear that. You'd only hear it when you combine them, start chaining them together. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like what you're saying about using a high gain amp after a pedal.
Oh, so this guy came back. Sorry, this guy came back in the chat, and they said it's a Marshall Class 5 amp head, and it wants to convert from 240 to 110. I have no idea in that amp if there's a universal transformer or not. Marshall generally did most of the time, but I'm not exactly sure, so I can't help you.
Most of the time, transformer is a lot more expensive to make a universal transformer like that, for one thing, because it has to work at 50 hertz to work here and there. But then that 50 hertz always costs more because you have to have a thicker stack on the transformer, more metal in the part that's not the coil of wire, but the metal part. So, you know, but generally, but so I would say if it was a less expensive product, it's probably not capable to be just converted and probably has to have a transformer change or something like that.
I'd have to see the schematic of it. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And then someone else said, someone asked me personally, is the Runt based off a Pink Taco or a BE? Well, they're all based off of BE. How's that? So it's the BE circuit. So I would say the Runt is actually a little more like a BE head than the Pink Taco is. But Pink Taco is a cathode biased, no negative feedback amplifier. It still has roughly the same preamp front end, maybe a few parts difference. But
so what is the BE preamp basically? I mean, if you were going to like cut
hot rotted Marshall type tone, classic hard rock kind of Marshall type tone.
I see.
Yeah. So that's what it would be. All my stuff is heavily. My favorite amp of all time was an old 50 watt Plexi Marshall that I used to use a Variac with. I still have it in the room here, and I used to use a Variac with it, and was biased for that, and just everything on 10 kind of thing, and that was always my favorite tone. So the amps just came about from that amp originally.
I see.
So I wanted to be able to capture that tone plus more gain if you want it or not, and a master volume that will work down low so you can play it quiet if you want.
Yeah.
So it came about like, okay, yeah, I love this tone, but not very practical.
Right.
For everyone.
And then those other amps are more or less based off of that same design with different power amps and.
Yeah, a lot of them are based off the same sort of building block, you know, with different tweaks and changes and stuff done to it. And except the Dirty Shirley amp I have is a different preamp section. It's still kind of a couple gain stage cathode father EQ circuit, you know. But
do you find the same thing that I find where people that like your stuff like everything you ever did?
Pretty much, yeah.
It's like there's something about what you like that all those people that like your stuff, they're like, they dig that.
Yeah.
And so whatever you do, you can't even get away from it. You don't know exactly why.
Well, you can't. But, you can't. I mean, well, okay, so I come up with something completely new, but I don't necessarily.
Still the same.
My ear hears it the same. So I'm going to. What the circuit is or the parts that are in, I'm going to tweak it to what I want to hear.
Right. So I do the same thing. It's like everybody that buys my stuff now says the same thing, that I've been playing your stuff for years. It's that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're attuned to us to the same, whatever it is about our, philosophy about how an amp should be or a pedal should be or a speaker should be or even a guitar should be, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it all kind of goes towards the same goal, I think.
Yeah.
So it's hard for you to do anything radically different, you know.
Right.
It all kind of has a flavor to it. One of my artists, a bass guy from Trapped, Peter Cheryl, told me the other day, he said he's been using the bass Tight Fuzz for years, and he got a pressurizer, which is a completely different thing. Not a fuzz, it's a compressor. And he said, you know, for some reason, it sounds just like it has a sound that's the same as that other thing, even though it's not anything like a fuzz, but it has a sound in it. So what happens is you can't help it, but you can't help but
it's kind of part. It's part of your DNA.
It's part of your DNA. It's like you can't help it.
Yeah.
You couldn't design something that didn't sound like you if you tried.
Right.
You know?
That's cool. You got your own secret sauce.
Exactly.
You know? I don't know about you guys. I'm getting tired.
Me too.
Okay. So I think I'm going to call in a night if you don't mind. I know we got a lot of people watching still. 166 people. It's been a great night, James. Thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it.
All your great stories. You know, you got an awesome career and a great company right now. I'm looking forward to meeting you at NAMM and seeing all your stuff.
Yep, me too.
And tell everybody where they can reach you, where they can find your products and stuff.
Well, of course, you know, we have a lot of dealers around, but the easiest way to find our stuff is at amptweaker.com.
Cool. And you're on the social media, Instagram and Twitter.
We got an Instagram account, Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. YouTube,
yes, Mark,
a lot of guys.
Yes, Mark, he's on the social media.
Exactly.
Yes, he's on the social media, yes.
You just made yourself really old there.
That's because I am really old. Oh, man, I'm getting there at least. Dave, everybody knows where to reach you, I think.
Yeah, Friedman Amps. FriedmanAmplification.com, or you can email us at FriedmanAmps@gmail.com. Perfect. You actually get me if you email that email address. So,
Great.
Now I'm going to get a ton of emails.
Yeah.
As if I don't have enough.
That's always fun. Guys, please hit subscribe to the channel. All right. And I hope everybody has a great holiday. We're going to try to plan on getting the next show in before the end of the year on the 29th. I think that's the next Friday before there's two Fridays coming up, I think, right?
Yep.
So, Dave, we're going to work on trying to get somebody cool for that night.
Yeah. No more of this lame ass James Brown amp tweaking stuff. Can y'all find somebody that's cool?
That is not what I meant.
Sorry, I know it's not. I'm just screwing around.
That's funny, man. No,
just messing with you.
Every show that we have is cool. That's what I have to say. Every show that
it is fun to talk about and reminisce about all that stuff. You know, I mean,
yeah,
important. It was an important part of my life, and I enjoy sharing it with people. You know.
Hey, I got one last thing. Just for the heck of it, you did some work with Adrian Vandenberg on some stuff. Did you? Did you say that?
Yep, when I first started at Peavey, Adrian was one of the first guys I dealt with, mm-hmm. And when I was working on the VTM, he was using it, and mm-hmm. And we did a little bit of tweaking with him on there. And actually, one of the most fun thing about that is I had never been involved in this stuff at all. You know, first show I ever went to and was backstage was a Whitesnake show in Chicago. Mm. And I got to sit on stage with the tech. And the lights were like coming over and hitting us and stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Know, back in the late 80s, it was a big deal. The light show and the whole nine yards, and it was all flamboyant and a big deal. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it was pretty wild to be able to be part of it at that time. But yeah, Adrian was cool.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. I've become friends with him a little bit. Just online mostly, but yeah, he seems really cool.
Yeah. So.
Very cool. Hey, you know what? Go ahead. Sorry.
That's it. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say there's one last question that I forgot to ask, Dave. This is from Joe Eller, and he wanted to know if you could just provide a little background on how the JJ Cantrell amp came about. And I'll leave it with that.
No, Let's see if I can. How that came about is years ago, I knew Jerry because I made his guitar rig for the tour for the record Wood. I guess it was called Wood. Mm-hmm. And that would be early 90s at some point in time. Early 90s. And I had done his guitar rig back then. So I hadn't seen him for a million years. And then later on, there was a sound man that I knew named Tom Abraham, who had been working. I knew him from working with Marilyn Manson and I'm trying to remember everyone he worked for at the time. But a lot of people. Tom Abraham was an amazing sound guy, one of the best in the business, actually.
Did you say Pearl Jam?
Marilyn Manson originally, I said.
No, I was talking about James. I thought he said Pearl Jam.
No, so Tom knew me and stuff, and he called me and he goes, "You got to come and help Jerry with his rig." So it started off working with Jerry with his new rig. He wanted to put a new rig together. So a million years later, 10 plus more years later, I put a new rig together for him, and at the time, I think he was using Bogner Ubershall, I think, and a I think it was a Bogner Ubershall when I first did it with a the lines the Alchemist, believe it or not. I put that together, and then I think then a guitar tech friend of mine took over the job. And then I made an amp for him because I said, "Hey, you should try this." And then he liked it. It was one of my BE amps, kind of nothing special. But then we tweaked it further to replace both his amps. So he's got one that's set higher gain and one set lower gain. One has effects on it, one doesn't. And It's a blend of the two all the time. And then it came about to do a model, a signature model. After he loved that and used it on tour, then he wanted to do his own signature model. And we talked to the management and worked out a deal. And that's how it came about.
Cool.
The rest is history. Yeah. That's cool. All right, cool. I wanted to make sure I got that question in because Joe has asked me twice. So,
yeah, no problem.
Very cool. And we've gotten the addresses for the winners of the contest. I've got that on my phone right here. Okay. So we're all set. And so another great show. James, you're awesome, man. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, it was a pleasure meeting you and your time. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it, too. We enjoyed it.
Yeah, you have a great holiday. And just hang on while I end the conversation. Everybody have a great weekend. By the way, happy birthday, Dave.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Not today, a couple days ago, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Happy birthday. All right, everybody. Have a great weekend. Take care.
All right. Cool.
Bye-bye.